Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Residents of East St. Louis will gather on Sunday to remember the victims of the 1917 race riot. On that day, 100 years ago, mobs of white people angered over labor issues roved through the city, assaulting African Americans and burning their homes and businesses. The legacy of the race riot has been forever etched into the family trees of its victims. St. Louis Public Radio's Mary Leonard recently spoke with three descendants of families touched by the violence. The Reverend Joseph Brown is chairman of the Race Riot Centennial Commission. His father taught him about the riot. Stephen Kaiser is the great-great-grandson of a white hardware store owner killed during the rioting. And Ann Walker is an East St. Louis historian. Her family came from Arkansas and Mississippi during the Great Migration.
The family had been established. Homes were bought, lived in, and they were prepared to bring the women and the children up. And on July 2nd, 1917, a group of those women and children were on the train coming in to East St. Louis. Charles Billups was the oldest, and he's the one who I have oral history on, who talks about being on the train, looking out the window, seeing this billow of smoke coming from where these grown people who were supposed to know better were taking him. Charles remembers being there at the time when the city looked like it was on fire. But he never expressed this to anybody. So finally, when I did ask about it, he just kind of poured it out to me.
My father and uncle had a hardware store, and they were the third generation in the family business. There was this picture of my great-grandfather, William. So I asked my father about it. He didn't really talk that much about him because at the time he was murdered in the race riots, my dad would have only been about 2.5. He told me that the streetcar was stopped in front of the hardware store and that there were white men who were attacking African Americans. That there was a family from St. Louis that were on their way back home and that white men had shot and killed the father, had shot and killed the son, and the wife was being attacked. My great-grandfather somehow got in between. What my father told me that my great-grandfather said was that you've already killed the husband and son, you know, spare the woman. At that point, they killed my great-grandfather. I think being an immigrant and whatever he had experienced before he came to the United States may have, you know, colored his approach or motivated him.
My father was my first teacher of black history. The story in my family was that his parents and he and his sister and brothers were living in that area where the riots took place, but for some reason their house was spared, but they hid people under their porch and in their basement. So I'm hearing this when I'm 5, 6, 7 years old. I have carried that voice memory in me forever. I was born in East St. Louis, and I lived there until I started seventh grade when my family moved. That was 1956, was when so many of the industries, which is also part of the story of the riots, because the industries that brought people up by the busload and trainload to help break unions, those same companies started leaving. While we commemorate the atrocities and call for healing of memories, there is a promissory note for East St. Louis that has still not been paid.
That's right. We move it to Mississippi, and you know how that spells. M-I, crooked letter I, crooked letter I, hump back I.
A historical marker along the Mississippi Freedom Trail honoring Emmett Till has been vandalized. In 1955, Till was accused of whistling at a 21-year-old white woman, Carolyn Bryant, outside of the grocery store where the sign was placed. The 14-year-old was kidnapped, tortured, and killed by two white men who were later acquitted by an all-white jury. According to Alan Hammonds, whose PR firm created the marker, someone scratched it with a blunt tool, removing most of the text and photographs of Till from the sign. As reported by Time.com, he told the Associated Press that the marker cost more than $8,000 and will cost another estimated $500 to repair. The AP also reports that another marker was shot at by the Tallahatchie River where Till's body was found. Carolyn Bryant, who now goes by the last name Dunham, has now admitted that she lied in her testimony against Till. She told the author of the book, The Blood of Emmett Till, quote, "Nothing that boy did could ever justify what happened to him."
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends, and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
A school district under fire for not revealing a threat against several students until 5 months after the fact. The revelation has found the Fremont Union High School District on the wrong end of a civil rights lawsuit. And tonight, the parent who brought the suit speaks exclusively with KTVU. Our South Bay reporter Jesse Gary now spoke with the angry and frightened mother. He joins us live from district headquarters, where representatives also responded to those allegations. Jesse, a lot coming out.
That's right, and district officials here say they notified law enforcement as soon as they were made aware of the kill list, but they didn't tell the parents of the students that were targeted, and that has some of those parents feeling betrayed.
I'm shocked. They were talking about how many bullets it would take to take her down in like a joking kind of manner.
We're concealing the identity of this parent to protect her daughter, a 16-year-old who was named on a Monte Vista High School kill list last fall. She says at first, Fremont Union High School district officials denied her daughter was involved, then said the teen was named but in a non-threatening way, and finally, that there was a specific threat to shoot and kill her daughter. But this parent never learned the facts until 5 months later.
Not unexpected, completely unexpected. I feel like I need to protect her, and it's on me to protect her and make sure that everything's okay.
A school publication first brought the offensive and disturbing chat room content to light in late September. Between 6 to 10 male students at Monte Vista and Fremont High Schools created what's entitled N-word kill list. We're substituting N-word, but the list actually uses the racist language. The list was posted to social media sites and detailed how many rounds would be needed to kill the half dozen black students that attended the schools. District officials never notified targeted students or their parents.
I feel like it crossed a major, major line, and it needs to be stopped. This shouldn't be a joking matter. You shouldn't joke about shooting somebody.
Why didn't the district tell parents about this back in September?
The main reason is it was immediately reported to the sheriff's department, and it was then a criminal investigation, so the district's role typically when law enforcement is involved is to stay out of it so as to not interfere with the investigation.
Attorney Mark Davis represents the school district. He says officials were told to let sheriff's investigators handle all aspects of the case, including notification. The sheriff's office declined our request for an on-camera interview. Sheriff Lori Smith previously issued the following statement. Quote, "It's a failure of our community to allow racist, vile, misogynistic discourse to flow freely within adolescent interactions. The sheriff's office began investigating in September, and our findings were recently turned over to the district attorney's office for criminal prosecution." Attorney Davis says the district disciplined the offending students.
The district does not in any way tolerate harassment. Brought those students in. They were all apologetic. They're all remorseful. They were sent to sensitivity training. And it's my understanding none of those were repeat offenders.
But the mother of a student targeted for death says concealing the threat broke a bond of trust with the school district. And now she's unsure if past threats of violence will materialize into actual violence.
I don't know who these people are. That's the scariest part.
The parent you just heard from removed her daughter from Monte Vista High School, but she says she still fears running into these children because they're still in the community and they don't know the identity of those kids. Speaking of which, the 6 to 10 children who were disciplined for making up the kill list, they're still enrolled in the school district. Now, we checked about criminal prosecution from the district attorney's office. We were told, and I'm quoting here, the office is still reviewing the situation, end of quotation. We're live in Sunnyvale this afternoon. Jesse Gary, KTVU, Fox 2 News.
There's nothing more refreshing than having a clear, crisp, clean glass of water on a warm summer's day.
That cool, refreshing drink.
Today was another beautiful day in the nation's capital, one in which many tourists shelled out their hard-earned bucks to stay hydrated, well-fed, and fueled up to see all the wonderful merriment D.C. has to offer. And on the National Mall, where there are long hikes between monuments and museums, sometimes this isn't so easy. So when a group of young teenagers decided to make a little cash and sell water, they thought it was a good way to fill a tough need that the National Park Service does not. After all, water is key to life. But nope. You can add helping people on a hot day to the list of things you can't do while black without getting harassed by the police. A picture from a longtime D.C. tour guide of teens handcuffed on the ground went viral over the weekend, pointing out just how different life can be for those of us who didn't have the luxury of slinging lemonade in the cul-de-sac. Stay classy, NPS. Less task forces, more water, please. You'll be doing everyone a favor. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
Tennessee.
Over the weekend, Chattanooga police arrested a man responsible for shaping the character of college athletes.
He's currently an assistant football coach at ETSU in Johnson City, and he also spent time as a Mox assistant coach here. His charge is threatening to kill a hotel clerk in Chattanooga.
Today, Allison Levine met with the victim of that assault. Allison, what did he have to say?
Kim Calvin, the hotel clerk, described a terrifying scene. An intimidating, intoxicated individual threatening his life. Only a narrow hotel desk separating the two men.
Standing outside of the Marriott Residence Inn, Brandon Sanders recalls his first meeting with Jeffrey Brumette.
He was a pretty big guy. He's way bigger than me, a lot taller than I am, so I was pretty intimidated.
Sanders says the ETSU football coach was angry and...
I mean, you can tell he's been drinking.
According to the affidavit, Brumette came into the lobby around 11:30, complaining about a faulty room key. Sanders says he made him another key.
He was telling other people in the elevator that everything that he's going to kill me, strangle me, hang me with a noose if his key didn't work.
Just minutes later, Brumette was back in the lobby.
And he started yelling, hitting the desk, just all kinds of crazy stuff. Most shocking thing was that he was going to hang me or beat me to a pulp because his key didn't work.
Sanders works the night shift at the hotel. He says he's never experienced anything like this before.
And people get mad because their keys don't work, but then you remake them, they go back upstairs and they're fine.
Police arrested Brumette in his hotel room shortly after the threats. According to the Hamilton County Jail, the football coach posted a $4,000 bail later that night.
I know he's been suspended. I know that much. Hopefully, he'll get some kind of punishment for it.
We confirmed through the UTC Athletic Department that Brumette was a defensive assistant coach for the UTC Mox in 2007. Calvin.
Thanks, Allison. ETSU spokesperson Joe Smith confirmed Brumette is suspended from his position with the football team.
Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That is the interaction with black people and white people every day, wherever they happen to be. It's going to be one of those categories, a combination of all three, before the day is over. But it doesn't get any better than tacky. I call it the three T's. Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That's it. Anywhere on the planet you are.
The owner of Rainy Street's newest bar, Unbarleavable, is apologizing. This all comes after calls for protest and boycotts after rude and racist comments and online reviews. KXAN's Alicia Enns live along Rainy Street with our top story.
Well, you know, the owner, Brandon Cash, is taking responsibility for this, saying it was wrong, it was inappropriate, and inexcusable. In fact, he sent us a statement saying, my own intolerable actions have contributed to a negative environment. He goes on asking the community for forgiveness and says he will earn it. Now, the bar has only been open since South by Southwest in March, and these comments coming out actually span over the last 3 months. It's just now blowing up on social media because one man decided enough is enough. Unbarleavable is causing some unbelievable reaction.
2 weeks ago, I was out on Rainy with a couple of friends, and we were choosing where we were going to go out. And somebody suggested Unbarleavable. And one of our friends said, you know, I had a really bad experience there a couple of months ago at South by Southwest. Let's go somewhere else.
That friend wrote a negative review claiming the bar left beer glasses in the shape of a swastika on the table and got no helpful response from the owner. The TABC is now investigating the case, saying all complaints related to allegations of discrimination or public safety concerns are investigated. Other customers have been sharing their reviews as well. In response to a Google review comment about poor service and a bad margarita, someone claiming to be the owner replied, since you had a towel on your head, my bartender thought you were the new busboy. Unbarleavable's replies have since been deleted, and their Yelp page is now being monitored.
A good person can't just stand back and let that sort of thing unfold without speaking up and doing something about it.
Rodriguez is organizing a protest. He says he's talked to 30 different organizations and political groups.
My goal isn't to block the entrance to the bar. My goal isn't to, you know, demean or say bad things about anybody related or not related with the bar that chooses to patronize it or not. My goal is just to share information and spread the word about what's gone on so that people can make their own informed decision.
Now, Brandon Cash not only owns Unbarleavable here, he owns two other bars in the Austin area, The Goodnight and The Rooftop on 6th Street. I also talked with the Rainy Neighborhood Association. They said they are aware of this incident, and they're kind of doing these conversations now to figure out what the next step would be. For now, we do know there is a protest planned here on Friday night. For now, we're live on Rainy Street. Alicia Enns, KXAN News.
World nigga law.
It's a case that shocked South Africa. Willem Oosthuizen and Theo Martins Jackson, both white farmers, have been charged with kidnapping and attempted murder. This camera phone footage of the attack shows them forcing victim Lotchwa into a coffin in November last year. They said he was trespassing and could be heard threatening to pour petrol on him before he escaped. It's touched a raw nerve for many. South Africa's three main political parties have held anti-racism protests outside the previous court sessions.
South Africa's history of oppression of the black majority by a white minority is violent. It's recorded here at Johannesburg's Apartheid Museum. These nooses symbolise opponents of the apartheid government who were executed. Their names are written here. It's recent, and although there's been democracy since 1994, economic inequality along racial lines still prevails, and many people feel that the racist attitudes of some white people haven't changed.
The coffin case is one of several incidents that have caused outcry against racism in recent years, many of them filmed and widely shared on social media, including this video of a white man threatening a black woman in a restaurant in March. Professor Mchabisi Ndeletiana is an expert on apartheid history.
The common belief within black society has been to reach out. We have a country to build, let's move on. But white folks have continued to cling to this prejudice, at least some of them, most of them. So there's a sense of black folks bending over and white folks snubbing them.
The debate over racism has been reignited. but some parts of the white community don't see it the same way. Ernst Root works for a rights organisation for white Afrikaners. He condemns the violence in the Coffin case, but he says white people are a threatened minority.
We are going to file criminal charges against 100 people who have encouraged white genocide since the beginning of this year. But that story, that doesn't make the news. Where I believe if a white person today were to go on Facebook and say, we must start killing black people, that would be a national news story. So I'm concerned about double standards in this country.
The magistrates referred Oosthuizen and Jackson's trial to a higher court because of the seriousness of the case. But more than 20 years after the end of white minority rule, many feel racial justice is a long way off. Malcolm Webb, Al Jazeera, Johannesburg, South Africa.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now? Why genetic annihilation? All these people from Syria coming up in here.
Italy has threatened to stop other countries' vessels disembarking migrants at its ports. The Italian representative to the European Union, Maurizio Massari, warned that the scale of migration across the Mediterranean from North Africa to Italy had become unsustainable. About 10,000 people are reported to have attempted the journey in the past few days. The British charity Save the Children is on the front line, rescuing migrants on the perilous journey. And just last night, a baby girl was born aboard one of their rescue ships before being brought to safety with more than 1,000 other people. It was the charity's largest operation to date. I spoke to Rob McGillivray, the charity's search and rescue director.
We have a search and rescue vessel which has a capacity of 350 people, but as we speak, we have 1,044 people on board. People are fleeing persecution, they're fleeing torture, sexual abuse. We have testimonies of women who have been raped on their journey towards Libya. It's with a great sense of relief when people reach port in Italy that they're finally, sometimes for many, many months, they have found a place of safety. You know, and one has to, you know, ask themselves the question, what does it take in order to place yourself or indeed your family on a boat which is ill-equipped to be able to make the journey even 20 miles out into the Mediterranean. That's a significant factor in the numbers of people crossing the Mediterranean Sea even as we speak.
Rob, Italy has threatened to stop vessels from other countries from disembarking migrants at its ports. What do you make of that?
I think the first thing to say is that Europe has a great debt towards Italy because Italy is the only country which has opened its borders to refugees and migrants crossing the Mediterranean. And that's been a massive thing. I think what underpins this issue is the absence of a joined-up European Union policy to be able to provide safe haven, humanitarian visas and safe passage into Europe.
You say that Europe needs to do more. Europe has said it will support the Libyan Coast Guard to stop these very dangerous boats from getting far out enough to be making that perilous journey. Does that not help save some lives?
It may save some lives. My sense is that if the Libya-Italy route was to cease, then new routes would open up, whether that's from Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco, then these journeys across to Italy are even more perilous than the one from Libya to Italy. So I don't think that the problem is solved by closing down the Libya route. All it does is it transfers the issue elsewhere. But until that solution is found, we will continue with what is the most fundamental form of humanitarian assistance, and that is saving lives at sea.
Rob McGillivray.
Serena Williams, Wimbledon champion for a sixth time. All the big trophies and the big titles in her hands at once.
Yesterday, tennis legend John McEnroe was quoted on the radio as having said that if Serena Williams played on the men's tour, she'd be something like the 700th best player. Of course, he was asked this question, so he replied, but he did have another option. He could have just called it what it was. A clown question, bro. Is this really still what we're doing in 2017? Casually marginalizing the most decorated tennis player of our time because she's not a man? She doesn't play on the men's tour because, hello, she is a woman. That's how it works. A couple hours later, she replied to him via Twitter. Dear John, I adore and respect you, but please keep me out of your statements that are not factually based. I've never played anyone ranked there, nor do I have time. Respect me and my privacy as I'm trying to have a baby. Good day, sir. Then she dropped a Vanity Fair cover of her naked and pregnant the next day. I'll bet I can think of something that no one on the men's tour can do either. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
If a state prosecutor says she opposes capital punishment, is it legal for the governor of that state to take cases away from her? That was a central question in front of Florida's Supreme Court today. Renata Sago from member station WMFE reports.
At the center of this dispute is Republican Governor Rick Scott's decision to take cases away from a Democratic state attorney from Orlando, Aramis Ayala, and reassign them to another prosecutor. Ayala attorney Roy Austin said the move was unprecedented.
Governor Rick Scott knows, and just as he told repeatedly citizens of the state of Florida, he does not have the authorization to override the prosecutorial discretion of an elected state attorney.
In March, Ayala said she would not seek capital punishment in the case of a man accused of killing a police officer and his pregnant ex-girlfriend. After she did, Governor Scott reassigned 24 of her murder cases to another state attorney. Austin told the justices that was wrong, one elected official taking power away from another.
What he has done here is he has simply decided he's taking a case away, and what he has written is that he can do it whenever he wants to do it.
But Florida Solicitor General Amit Agarwal, who's representing the governor, said Scott's move was to protect justice.
No one individual in our society has the right to say, I've taken a hard look at this, I've considered all the available evidence, I've figured out this issue, and I'm going to make a policy judgment that is blanket across the board.
After court today, Ayala told reporters there's no law in Florida that requires her to seek the death penalty in capital cases.
There was no blueprint for me to follow. I did what I believed was proper under Florida law, and no laws have been violated.
At times during the court hearing, justices were skeptical whether a prosecutor could oppose state laws universally or on a case-by-case basis. Whatever the Florida Supreme Court decides, it could set a precedent for sweeping changes across the state. For NPR News, I'm Renata Sago in Tallahassee.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Members of the public packed an auditorium at the University of Washington last night to express grief and outrage over the death of Charlena Lyles. Lyles was shot by Seattle police officers who said she threatened them with knives. As KUOW's Amy Radel reports, people asked for stronger police discipline and training and worried about the fate of Lyles' four children.
Seattle City Council member Lorena Gonzalez convened Tuesday's hearing after requests from Lyles' family and the NAACP. She says she invited Seattle Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole, but O'Toole could not attend. So instead, the nine city council members were on stage as people spoke, shouted, and even sang about the impact of Lyles' death.
She died on Father's Day. That's the worst part about it.
That's Lyles' father, Charles, who came to Seattle from California for the event. He says his daughter's four children have been split up into different households.
It's just so sad that their mother's gone and they are separated.
Lorna Murray lived upstairs from Lyles in the Brettler family place housing in Sand Point. She says one of the most upsetting details of Lyles' death was the police officer's failure to carry his taser that day.
But for the fact that he left his taser in his locker, I would be able to be yelling at Charlene tomorrow and telling her kids to stay away from my car with their bikes. But instead, four children don't have their mother.
And longtime activist Reverend Harriet Walden, who founded the group Mothers for Police Accountability, seemed to despair that her efforts on crisis intervention training and less lethal measures for police officers are still not bearing fruit.
20 years we have worked for less lethal. 20 years, and this system failed. Ms. Lyles, I'm outraged.
Walden is also a member of Seattle's Community Police Commission, which worked to pass recent legislation for stronger police oversight. Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez said she wanted the hearing to help promote healing and ideas for preventing future police shootings. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
After 200 years of slavery, the black people now outnumber the white people in many parts of the South. Well, you can pretty much guess what came next. The slaves started rebelling. There were uprisings. An old master's head got chopped off. And when white people heard of this, they were freaking out and going, I want to live. Don't kill me, big black man. Well, just in the nick of time came Samuel Colt, who in 1836 invented the first weapon ever that could be fired over and over without having to reload. And all the Southern whites were like, yee-haw! But it was too late. The North soon won the Civil War and the slaves were freed. Yep, they were free now to go chop all the old master's heads off. And everybody was like, oh no, we're gonna die. But the freed slaves took no revenge. They just wanted to live in peace. But you couldn't convince the white people of this. So they formed the Ku Klux Klan. And in 1871, the same year the Klan became an illegal terrorist organization, another group was founded, the National Rifle Association. Soon politicians passed one of the first gun laws, making it illegal for any black person to own one. It was a great year for America. The KKK and the NRA. Of course, they had nothing to do with each other, and this was just a coincidence. One group legally promoted responsible gun ownership, and the other group shot and lynched black people.
We're turning back now to the story of Philando Castile, the Minnesota man who was killed in his car by a police officer last July. A little more than a week ago, a jury acquitted the police officer who shot Castile, Officer Geronimo Yanez, on manslaughter and other charges. There are many questions about this story, including the fact that the officer shot Castile in front of a four-year-old child sitting in the back seat. In a few minutes, we'll talk about what it means to a child to witness something like that. But first, we're going to tackle the fact that Castile was killed after disclosing he had a weapon in the car for which he had a permit. And for some, this raises the question of whether gun ownership, while a right in theory, is actually a race-based privilege in reality. We wanted to talk about this with somebody with both a personal and professional take. So we found Nicholas Johnson. He is a professor of law at Fordham University in New York. He is a gun owner, a member of the NRA, and he is African American. We reached him at his home in Yardley, Pennsylvania, and I started our conversation by asking him about his own personal history with guns.
So I grew up in rural West Virginia, so I grew up with guns. I joked recently with someone that until I was about 15 years old, I don't think I knew anyone who didn't have a gun.
Does this incident itself and the lack of legal consequence anyway create feelings in you as an African-American gun owner for whom guns are a part of your life?
I've talked with a variety of people about this and friends who are gun owners, et cetera. And one of the things that happens is that people tend to treat it as if that's the only point of decision making for millions of people out there who are, you know, sort of proceeding in line with the kinds of concerns that the case raises. But the truth of the matter is that lots of people who owned firearms before this episode and will continue to own them after this episode are influenced by not only this thing, but a variety of things that have occurred over the course of many years.
But what about police conduct, though? I mean, if the implication here is that one is justifiably in fear of one's life solely because an African-American man discloses that he has a weapon, does that not indicate that that's not a right? It's a race-based privilege and not a right. I mean, wouldn't that be a...
So this actually goes to a broader question. Like it or not, we allow police to use guns in a range of circumstances that go far beyond the traditional self-defense rules that apply to individual citizens. And the truth is that we allow police to draw guns, to point guns, to threaten with guns in scenarios where private parties would be arrested for a variety of those actions that police are either expressly or tacitly, implicitly authorized to engage in. So then the question becomes, does the tacit license allow racism to creep in? And I think there's no doubt that it does. The question, what to do about that tacit license, is a really difficult structural question.
But what does that mean? Does that mean that this is a sad state of affairs and that nothing can be done? Or you feel what's the bottom line?
I am quite skeptical about the ability of politicians to structure a set of rules that will filter down adequately to line officers in a way that will actually eliminate the threat of these sorts of events. I mean, I've been profiled. I've been stopped for walking while black on suspicion of being a Hispanic man with no front teeth who had committed murder. So I've had most of the standard negative interactions with police. I also have had very good interactions with police. I suppose that if you were to speculate about this, you would say, well, let's start punishing in more aggressive ways officers who make the wrong decision. That's a matter of political will. It's also a matter of sort of getting at, you know, what if juries disagree? I mean, how do you get into the jury room and prevent juries from letting off officers in the way that they did in this case? I guess this is a council of despair. I mean, I don't know what one does here.
Nicholas Johnson is a professor of law at Fordham University in New York City. He's also written extensively about gun ownership and firearm policy. Professor Johnson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And I am so very, 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 very disappointed in the system here in the state of Minnesota, because nowhere in the world do you die from being honest and telling the truth. Now, these are some things that you need to know and recognize. There has always been a systemic problem in the state of Minnesota.
Over the last 2 weeks, three police officers have avoided conviction in the fatal shootings of black men. A day after Officer Geronimo Yanez was acquitted for killing Philando Castile, Man Booker Prize-winning writer Marlon James offered his thoughts on being a black man in Minnesota. He's originally from Jamaica, but has been teaching at McAllister College in St. Paul for the past 10 years. His essay is titled Smaller and Smaller and Smaller, and it's gone viral. Marlon James joins us now from his office in Minneapolis. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What is it about this moment that made you want to write this so directly?
I think it was the frustration and the familiarity, the fact that this is not the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, or tenth time that this has happened. And it's funny because I don't walk around with a sense of dread, but it occurred to me how easily I could have matched the description of something else or someone else, and how easily I could be dead, because we're not a situation where cops in the company of seven or eight still feel threatened by a guy several feet over with his hands up. So we're just kind of not sure where to go. We don't know what to do. We don't know how to stand. We don't know how to sit. We don't know how to speak. We just don't know what to do other than sit back and just hope this will pass.
As you mentioned, there just seems to be a moment of what do we do? How can this change?
Well, it's like what Claudia Rankine says in Citizen, you know, until our white brothers and sisters start policing their own imaginations, then these will continue to happen. One thing we forget, and funny enough, it was a policeman who pointed this out, for nearly every situation where the cops show up, there's somebody who called. There's a person who called and said there's a thief breaking into his house. There's a person who looks at somebody who's lived in a neighborhood for 30 years and said they think some black guy is lurking around. And we don't talk about people policing their own imaginations before the police show up and escalate it. And I think that's something we have to look at as well. Who are these people making these calls? Who are these people saying they feel threatened? I think nobody gets off the hook.
In this essay, you really talk about Northern white culture, and you pull a quote from Dick Gregory,
He says, down south, white folks don't care how close I get as long as I don't get too big. Up north, white folks don't care how big I get as long as I don't get too close. Mm-hmm. That seems to be speaking to what you're talking about.
That in a lot of ways was the impetus for the whole essay, I guess. What I see here is a lot of what I call the dude I don't see color problem. The problem with being colorblind, the problem with being I don't think about race, is that you never see the absence of it. So if you're at a party of 100 people in 2017 and everybody's white, that's a pretty messed up party. I don't care where you are. I still think Northerners feel they have a sort of moral advantage over the South. At least they fought on the right side. And it's weird that we're still talking about North and South and Civil War and all of that. But I think there's a certain belief, certainly among the North, that a lot of stuff about race they've dealt with. And they really haven't.
Hmm. What's been the reaction to your essay?
Well, the reaction for some people have been, you know, surprise and sadness and sometimes outright shock. I think sometimes, even though I'm black, I think because I have a certain level of academic privilege or because I'm well known, that maybe these things would have escaped me. And for the most part, they do. But that doesn't change that when I jump on the road, I'm riding my bike, I'm wearing my worn down t-shirt and shorts, I'm just another person on the road. I also think that there is a kind of guilt, I guess, because this is not the first time they're hearing what I'm saying. They've heard it from other people. We'll say it every time somebody's killed or victims don't get justice. The question is, when do we stop talking and start to work towards change? And to a huge extent, mainstream Americans, white Americans, have a big role to play in that. I think there's this kind of idea that communities of color have this major role to play in the end of discrimination. That's like saying women have a role to play in erasing rape. They don't. Men need to stop raping. It's a very tricky thing, still waiting on guidance from the victim or potential victim on how to move forward. I think people need to start thinking about what to do instead of asking victims how to do it.
Marlon James is the author of A Brief History of Seven Killings, which won the Man Booker Prize in 2016.
Medical
Thank
apartheid.
You so much for joining us.
The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present.
Now for an improbable love story. Now here you might be thinking, aren't the bookshelves groaning with those? But here's a love story that did not just change two people's lives. It shed light on inequalities that our next guest says are deeply embedded in a system that affects thousands of people every day. The love story starts with Dr. Vanessa Grubbs. She was a family doctor, and she hadn't planned on falling in love with a man who'd been living with kidney disease since he was a teenager. But when she did, it set her life on a new course. Appalled by his years-long wait time for a kidney donor, she decided to donate one of her kidneys to him. And then she began to study, document, and fight against what she began to see as subtle but nonetheless very real racial biases in the decisions over who gets those precious transplant organs. Oh, and the guy? She married him. And 11 years later, they are still going strong. She writes about all this in a candid new memoir, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers. And I started our conversation by asking her how falling in love with a man living with kidney disease changed the way she thought about kidney disease.
When I saw patients with kidney failure, it was all about taking care of the numbers, getting the orders right. I really wasn't engaged in their lives. I was taking care of diseases and not necessarily patients with illnesses. Through him, I could see that dialysis isn't easy. People have cramping. They can feel really tired after. Sometimes they get infections. Robert was only 26 when he started dialysis. And by then, he had, you know, kind of figured out his new normal.
Could you just talk a little bit about what it's like for him? Like when you met him, what was his life like? What was hard about it?
Because he was such a young man, dialysis changed the way he saw life. No longer could he have the luxury of hoping about a future because it wasn't guaranteed on dialysis. We lose 20% of our dialysis patients every year. The dialysis procedure itself can really sap the energy, particularly if they're only having dialysis three times a week, which is what he was going through. For him, he needed to take a break after dialysis. Otherwise, he would end up paying for it, like feeling really lightheaded once he even passed out at work. So one of his biggest ways to deal with it was to go watch a movie or occasionally go get a mani-pedi. A lot of people wouldn't believe that to see him because he is a big linebacker kind of guy, but he very much enjoys getting his mani-pedis.
Knowing all this, I mean, knowing that, you know, it can be hard to travel, that it can be fatiguing, did you hesitate to get involved with him?
I did hesitate about him being on dialysis. And what I was really concerned about was his dialysis access. And if you don't have your dialysis access, which is the way that we are able to connect a person to the machine, then they're in trouble because that's really their lifeline. And so I asked to see Robert's fistula, that's his dialysis access, on the second date. And for me to see how robust it was reassured me that it was okay to consider getting involved with him.
Yeah, that's not generally something that you'd ask on Tinder, but yeah, maybe we should incorporate that. Show me your fistula?
Yeah, you know, we joked that instead of him approaching women with "what's your sign," it was "what's your blood type? Maybe we can be compatible." It's medical nerd humor.
Medical nerd humor. Well, there you go. So you're dating, you're getting to know him, and you start going to dialysis with him. When did you start to think, why is he waiting so long for a donor when he is otherwise healthy, except for his kidney disease, certainly not an intravenous drug user, has insurance, basically none of the stereotypes people may have about kidney patients?
Yeah, it was when I went with him to his transplant evaluation. He got a notice that he was nearing the top of the list, and this is something where they want to just check on a person, make sure they still want to transplant, make sure they're still healthy enough. And it was quite an eye-opening experience. You know, as I said, I was a primary care doctor at the time, but I really had no idea about what happens in this kidney transplant world. And it was in that moment that I thought, oh my goodness, this system is really biased. And it was in that moment that I said, you know, we should see if I can give you one of my kidneys.
Yeah, and here's where we kind of get into the nitty gritty here. You know, you write, for example, that African Americans are 1 in 3 of the candidates awaiting kidney donation, but they receive only 1 in 5 of the donated kidneys. White people are also about 1/3 of the candidates awaiting kidney donations, but they receive every other donated kidney. And then you say it is an assumption that African Americans or blacks don't donate enough organs. That's not true. So what is the deal? Why is it that African Americans are, as you put it, good for harvest, but not for planting? What conclusion did you come to?
In addition to being inspired to be Robert's donor, eventually I decided to become a nephrologist, really in an effort to do something for everyone else. I mean, I gave Robert a kidney. For everyone else, it was to try to do research into the area. And being in nephrology really opened my eyes to just how big the problem is throughout the system. The problems start way before a person gets to transplant. And all of these things have room for human error. So, for example, people have to know that they have kidney disease. We know for a fact that most people aren't aware that they have kidney disease. You can't get to even the evaluation unless a nephrologist refers you and you have health insurance that will pay for the evaluation.
You and your guy, Robert, are still together.
Yeah.
How's he doing?
He's doing really well. We celebrated our 12th transplant anniversary in April, and we celebrate our 12th wedding anniversary in August. And he never required dialysis after the hospitalization. He's leading a very full life, even has his dream job right now.
That was Dr. Vanessa Grubbs. She is a nephrologist at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital. She was kind enough to join us from member station KQED. Her new book, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match, is out now. Dr. Grubbs, thank you so much for speaking with us, and our very best wishes to you and your guy.
Thank you so much. Hey, don't block my shade. Turn down the sun.
There is no perfect way to protect your skin from sun damage, and whether you have to lather up constantly or never get a sunburn, depends on the pigment, the melanin that makes up your skin. Now, melanin produced by your body isn't something you can change at will. But a group of researchers has discovered a way to create a melanin-like substance in the lab that can be tuned to different shades, darker or lighter, which corresponds with UV protection. So could we soon see products containing melanin-like material replacing the traditional sunscreens on the market today? Here with me to discuss this new research is my guest, Ryan Uhlein, professor of chemistry and director of the Nanoscience Initiative at the Advanced Science Research Center at City University here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
So what's the connection between melanin and its UV properties on your body?
So melanin is an incredibly interesting material. It serves many functions across all living species. It provides UV protection. It provides free radical scavenging, and it can also have other properties like mechanical properties. And so it's a protective layer found in many species. The way it's produced in a biological context is it's essentially made in small organelles known as melanosomes, and there's a polymerization reaction that takes place inside these melanosomes, and that makes the melanin-like material. And as you're exposed to UV more, the body responds to that and produces more of that material.
So is your research saying that basically you have made synthetic melanin?
It's not strictly synthetic melanin. I would say because it has some chemical signatures that are slightly different. So the purist would say it's not synthetic melanin. However, it's potentially even more exciting because it is highly tunable, and we can control the properties of this synthetic melanin mimic.
It changes color, and when you put it in UV, it's in a petri dish, and you shine light on it, and it turns darker.
Not dynamically like that. Let me try to explain how it works. So the way biology does this is, as I said, by a polymerization reaction that starts with tyrosine, a common amino acid found everywhere in the body. So tyrosine is polymerized, is first oxidized to a highly reactive oxidizing species, and these polymerize. So these form long, complex chains of molecules, and you end up with a polymer and a network type polymer that then has the unique melanin properties. The difficulty is, though, that the cool thing about biology is that this is all very tightly regulated. So it is a polymerization that's guided, and it's guided by assembly of these precursors. So they're not just freely available to react, you know, where they can. They are presented appropriately so that a tunable melanin and a reproducible melanin is formed. And that's been very difficult to reproduce in the lab. So if you take tyrosine and you oxidize it in the lab, you can make black insoluble polymers, but they are not very useful because they don't have tunable and precise properties.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you joined us, we're talking with Ryan Uhlein of CUNY here. So you got, but now you're able to tune it to different colors. And what practical use now can we make? You make a cream out of this or what?
Yeah, so let me first quickly explain how we tune it, because
we only have a few minutes left.
Sure, so. Right. So the tunability relates to how we pre-organize the tyrosine molecules, and that gives us a different color. So yes, you now have a material that is has properties that are dependent on the ingredients that you put in the first place. So you could process this in water. To ultimately have an ingredient that you could add to cosmetic creams, and I'm not a cosmetics expert, but we've talked to a couple of cosmetics companies, and they believe that these things have real applications as ingredients for cosmetic products.
And how much of the ultraviolet could you actually block out?
So what we have so far is we've demonstrated that we can cover the UVA and the UVB range. Depending on, again, the ingredients, so that's the tunability, we can access UVA more or UVB more. Yes, we can have a level of SPF. How it compares with existing materials is hard to tell at the moment.
So I'm envisioning sort of a switch or something. I can change the color of my melanin that I'm putting on, the synthetic stuff that you're making.
Yeah, it's not an in situ switch. Yeah. It is a predetermined switch. So you would have to in advance decide what kind of pigmentation you're looking for. And in that sense, it is tunable.
So could you go like into a tanning center like we have now instead of getting exposed to UVA or whatever? You could be sprayed with all over your body with what you have, or are you thinking it's more topical? Where you're
it's
have
more
it?
Topical actually. Yeah. It's nothing to do with the tanning station. It would be really like a think about a cosmetic product that has SPF built in.
Right.
Those are very, very common. So this could be an ingredient that replaces the existing SPF.
Any FDA approval yet?
No, we are. It's early days. We've been doing this for the past year, but we are hopeful because all the ingredients that we use to make these materials are themselves derived from amino acids, and they have a good status at FDA. They have so-called GRAS status.
Yeah, I know what that is.
Yeah.
What else? What's the one thing that's missing now? Where's the next step?
Well, there's a lot more that needs to be done. I mean, despite the fact that we can now control the formation of these materials much better than what was possible previously, there are still many questions about exactly how the chemical connection works and how exactly the function relates to the molecular properties. So this is something that can keep us going for quite some time. There are also more exotic applications. We're working with a collaborator at Carnegie Mellon University, Christopher Bettinger, who's looking at battery-like applications of these materials. So there's no shortage of exciting things that can be done now that we can tune the formation of these materials.
Battery, charging battery with solar? Maybe.
Not solar charged. It would be an ion storage capacity, so releasing ions on demand and use that as a electric storage.
Wow. So you could start out with melanin for the skin and wind up with a breakthrough in battery storage technology.
I don't know.
You don't know what path you might take on it.
Yes, well, that will be probably a decade down the line, but certainly as scientists, it keeps us excited and keeps us going.
We like it when you get excited. Thank you, Ryan Uihlein, Professor of Chemistry, Director of the Nanoscience Initiative at CUNY's Advanced Science Research Center. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Frantz Fanon, revolutionary journalist. Those who have studied the global black revolution of the 20th century have had to read the masterwork of Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, which was known as the handbook of the black revolution from Accra in Ghana to Oakland in California. This work, as much a psychological study as a diagnosis of the nature of French colonialism in Algeria, gave militants tremendous insights into the nature of imperialism and how resistance exploded against it. Former Black Panther leader Kathleen Neal Cleaver has written that Fanon's influence on black revolutionaries in the U.S. was profound. But before he published The Wretched of the Earth, he wrote a remarkable series of articles anonymously for the Algerian revolutionary journal El Mujahid from September 1957 to January 1960. El Mujahid's attacks on the French political and military colonial officials is unusually sharp and focused, reflecting Fanon's unique psychological and ideological insights into the Algerian and African struggles against imperialism. El Mujahid is an Arabic term meaning one who wages jihad or struggle, and here one sees Fanon in a potent war of words against the foreign occupation of Algeria. But Fanon was far more than a word warrior. In his 1964 work, Toward the African Revolution, we find Fanon, the critic, the political analyst, the Africanist, the internationalist, the Marxist, and the anti-imperialist. In his El Mujahid articles, Fanon anonymously gives voice to the FLN, French, Front Libération Nationale, English, National Liberation Front, and ridicules French efforts to tie the FLN to rapes, killings, and massacres, condemns Arab and African collaborators, and dissects how French forces use torture to intimidate the Algerian resistance. Fanon writes, "Torture in Algeria is not an accident or an error or a fault. Colonialism cannot be understood without the possibility of torturing, of violating, or of massacring." Fanon was a revolutionary journalist, or perhaps more clearly, a revolutionary who also worked as a journalist. His heart was with all anti-imperialist, revolutionary, and national liberation movements. His heart was with rebel friends like Nkrumah of Ghana and Lumumba of Congo. His heart was with what he called the wretched of the earth, the world's dispossessed. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
The big story on Action News is the investigation into a deadly case of road rage. Police now say an 18-year-old girl was shot in the head by another driver before her vehicle crashed in Chester County. That young victim died at the scene, and now police are still on the hunt for her killer. Action News reporter Catherine Scott is live in West Goshen Township Forest this afternoon with word of a new reward in this very gruesome case. Catherine.
That's right, Alicia. Meanwhile, investigators have been interviewing witnesses. They've been searching for more surveillance footage as they continue to try to track down this driver. And we learned this morning that a $5,000 reward is now being offered by Crime Stoppers in this case. The search is on for the man in this faded red pickup truck who shot and killed 18-year-old Bianca Roberson in West Goshen in an apparent case of road rage.
I don't know what kind of person has the mentality to be like, okay, I can just shoot this person, it's fine, and like just drive away.
Roberson just graduated from Ruston High School in Westtown and was bound for Jacksonville University in Florida. Once again today, grief counselors were available for students.
Our thoughts and prayers go out to the family and the friends of Bianca. It's tough to lose a child under any conditions, but now that more information is coming out about this as a potential homicide, very tragic. So we're just trying to help kids through this.
Roberson had just left the mall late Wednesday afternoon after shopping for college clothes with her mother and grandmother. She was traveling south on Route 100 in her 2009 Chevy Malibu when investigators say Bianca and a man driving a faded red pickup truck were trying to merge into the same lane. It's where the highway goes from two lanes to one. They were jockeying for position when the man pulled out a gun and shot the 18-year-old in the head. He fled her car, then veered off the road and crashed around 5:30 p.m. Former classmates were stunned.
It was one thing for it to be from a car crash, from road rage, but to find out the updates of last night of her being shot was just, that's what really hit home for me. It made it like 10 times worse.
Investigators are looking for tips as her family grieves.
She was a good girl, honor roll student, looking forward to going to college.
Turn yourself in now. Every second you are out there, you are only making this worse for yourself and worse for this young lady's family.
This faded red pickup truck, possibly a Chevrolet, was last seen exiting 202 south of Paoli Pike. Investigators want to hear from you if you have any tips.
white nigga, dark nigga, faux nigga, real nigga, rich nigga, poor nigga, house nigga, feel nigga, still nigga. Still nigga. I like that second one. Light nigga, dark nigga, faux nigga, real nigga, rich nigga, poor nigga, house nigga, feel nigga, still nigga. Still nigga. OJ like, I'm not black, I'm OJ. Okay. House nigga, don't fuck with me. I'm a field nigga with Sean Cutlery. Go play the quarters where the butlers be. I'ma play the corners where the hustlers be. I told him, please don't die over the neighborhood that your mama rentin'. Take your drug money and buy the neighborhood. That's how you rinse it. I bought every V12 engine. Wish I could take it back to the beginning. I could have bought a place in Dumbo before it was Dumbo for like $2 million. That same building today is worth $25 million. Guess how I'm feeling? Dumbo. Light nigga, dark nigga, faux nigga, real nigga, rich nigga, poor nigga, house nigga, feel nigga, still nigga. Light nigga, dark nigga, faux nigga, real nigga, rich nigga, poor nigga, house nigga, feel nigga, still nigga. Still nigga.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 1st, 2017, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have observations, thoughts, suggestions. If you have commentary on some of the news clips we heard just the last hour, feel free. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Right on, a couple things before we get to folks who called. Number one, we are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. That is the blog, the address again, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you visit my blog, look in the top right corner, you'll see the PayPal button. Invest if you think the broadcast is constructive. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. I moved today, so new mailing address. If you need to mail Gus T anything, then you should verify that you have correct mailing information. Even though I did not have an opportunity to get any furniture assembled, I barely found the computer components that I needed to get my computers rolling, but was still able to get the compensatory call-in broadcast together. Clips, everything was posted, ready to roll, in spite of, did things efficiently in a codified manner. Right on. A couple things I wanted to share before we get to the callers, and even a listener mailed something that she wanted to share as well. In fact, I think I'll go ahead and do that now because it's short. So this report, successful African-American community under investigation by Republican suspected racists. This was reported two days ago, June 28th. Examining the decline in violence, cognitive scientists, psychologist, linguist, and popular science author Steven Pinker concludes in The Better Angels of Our Nature, across time and space, the more peaceable societies also tend to be richer healthier, better educated, better governed, more respectful of their women, and more likely to engage in trade. Prince George's County, Maryland, is home to 7 out of 10 richest African-American communities in the United States. More African-American wealth is gathered in the county than anywhere else in the U.S. It is also home to the best educated in the nation as well. So it came as a shock when Maryland's Governor Larry Hogan requested an investigation into data showing increased graduation rates in the county. The governor claims that grades and credit counts are being altered to increase the rate. Is it possible? Certainly. If the allegations are true, it would not be anything new. Schools have been accused of this for a long time, especially when it comes to student athletes. With school funding being tied to increased academic performance, cheating has been discovered from West Virginia in the 1980s to Atlanta in 2011. I should have wagered. What do you want to put down that Atlanta's going to be mentioned in this? Anyway. But why is Prince George's County specifically being targeted out of all the counties in Maryland? One unsettling coincidence is the county executive announcing his run for governor against Hogan less than a week before this investigation was called for. Under Russian Baker's administration, crime has fallen dramatically thanks largely to a neighborhood initiative the administration launched that focuses on reducing crime in targeted areas. Homicides dropped 40% in 4 years, and violent crime fell 36%. Under Baker's watch, the county has regained the population it lost during the housing crisis, and in the past few years, Prince George's has drawn more new residents than all but one other jurisdiction in the fast-growing Washington, D.C. area, growing with individuals classified as white. With those types of improvements, is it really a surprise that graduation rates have increased? Even the unemployment rate is down significantly. 2012 also marked the lowest rate of rape ever reported. According to Bob Wise, president of the Alliance for Excellent Education, compared to high school dropouts, high school graduates are less likely to be unemployed, less likely to tangle with the criminal justice system. If graduation rates in Prince George's County were rising, but other indicators were worsening, an investigation would certainly be worthy. But the effects of increased graduation rates are clearly apparent in Prince George's County. Perhaps Governor Hogan should turn his attention to Carroll County, first in the state in graduation rates, but with a troubling rise in crime. But he probably won't, given that 91% white county voted for him in the 2012 election. Very nice final sentence to bring it all the way back around to show that when you have something that looks kind of suspicious and white people are doing it, no call for investigation. The niggers, under any circumstances, we are going to go down and investigate them down to elementary school. They are not supposed to know how to get to A and then to B at the age of 5. That is an investigation. They're cheating, and we're going to lock those niggers up. And I knew Atlanta was going to be mentioned. They are going to be racially showcased for probably the next 10, 15, 20 years, anytime they talk about any allegations of cheating at school. It's, oh yeah, like the niggers in Atlanta. Remember they had to throw about 20 of them in jail, just cheating left and right. Poor niggers couldn't learn. Next thing that stood out, I'm writing a report this weekend on difficulties that black male teachers encounter. We talked about that a little bit with Dr. Curry when he was with us this week. If there are any black male teachers, if you would be interested in sharing your experience, your thoughts, kind of based on what your experience has been or what you know now, would you even be a teacher? Like, if you could go back and do it all over again, would you still be an educator in the system of white supremacy? If you would like to participate, drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. I got a Facebook, I think a couple Facebook messages from a couple folks, and looks like a good number of people. So I will reach out to everyone if you are interested in sharing your experience, untiljustice@gmail.com. Just drop me an email. As I said, this, trying to be serious journalist, It would be great if you want to go on record with your name, but I certainly understand the logic of anyone who says, hey, you know, I cannot do that because I think the race soldiers that I work with every day would, you know, terminate me or make things even worse for me. I totally understand. So the way we could do it is if you just say, like, Seattle public school system, right? That's where I am. Seattle public school system, or Tacoma public school system, or the Oakland public school system, whatever it is. We could say we could do it that way. And then you could just share your experience from there. But that's if that's acceptable. But drop me an email if you would like to participate. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Okay. The report from some of the news reports that we heard in the report where they were talking about the former assistant football coach, excuse me, current assistant football coach at East Tennessee State University. This race soldier threatened to lynch a white hotel employee because his key didn't work. I thought that was significant. I still played it. If you watch the video, and if anyone out there, if you want to see it, I think B Moore posted it on my Facebook page, but I can post it again if you want to see the video footage of them talking to the victim and about this whole incident. But he did not threaten a black person. He did not threaten to lynch a black person because his hotel key didn't work. He threatened a white person. I still think that is significant. Just the fact that this is just my assessment. It could be an error. This is just speculation, but from different reports that I'm seeing on a regular basis, it seems like there is a zeitgeist of we want to go back to the way things were done previously in handling niggers. When we used to go out and get a rope and show these niggers what business is, it seems like make America great again. That's when we were at our best. We would get our rope and, you know, do what's what, do what's needed. And it just seeing that consistently, they had the case not that long ago where some little white urchins were threatening. I think they might have even had a noose and were threatening black students at school. It's been so many of these incidents, even to have a white person threatening to lynch another white person over a hotel key, something small, just kind of shows me the nature of white culture, number one, and it just kind of gives me an assessment for current behavior, what's happening in terms of white pathology, current white pathology. Next, the report from the Rainy Street bar where they had these allegations that they had put the beer mugs in the shape of a swastika, and other people stepped forward and said that they had an unpleasant experience and that perhaps racism, white supremacy was practiced. They changed and used the term discrimination. They used a lot of what they call legalese when they went to the company and they said any incidents of discrimination, we have to investigate and all that. Not reports or allegations of racism, white supremacy, but discrimination. Again, racists very, very skillful at the use of words to deceive. We have talked about Frantz Fanon a lot, excuse me, on the program. I think we should read Frantz Fanon for the book club, so I'll use this opportunity if any listeners would be interested in narrating, because I think my limit for the year is one book narration per year, and I'm doing my one right now with Gil Scott Heron. So if any listeners would be interested in narrating Frantz Fanon, we can vote whether we want to do Wretched of the Earth or Black Skin, White Mask, given my assessment of Cal's listeners' enjoyment and eagerness to discuss Area 8. I would think it should be a landslide victory for Black Skin, White Mask, which is the shorter book of the two. But it makes no difference to me because I'm not reading it. So if folks that are interested for the book club, Black Skin, White Mask, Wretched of the Earth, I think that's what we should read next. People can vote on what they would like to do. And then if we have any folks that would like to read, male or female, I don't really think it matters that much if we have a female narrator. So if any folks would like to read, let me know that as well. UntilJustice@gmail.com. The final comment I will get in, the situation in Florida where Governor Scott is taking the case away from this black female who they threatened to lynch not that long ago, just this year, because she wouldn't pursue this death penalty case. And I think they even sent a noose to her office. That's what I mean. Just paying attention to what I'm seeing on a regular basis. Anywho, so Governor Scott said, oh, no, you're not going to pursue a death penalty case, I'll take this away from you if you're going to be some uppity, you know, sassy negress and forget your place. Now, discretion was used in that report. I've been saying for about a year, I think even a little longer than a year at this point, about the significance of the word discretion. I mention it on workplace racism all the time. In this case, and this is, they have whole books. This is one where they have whole fields of study with regards to the law and discretion, because police officers, enforcement officers like Daniel Holtzclaw, have a lot of discretion about when they get to stop you, when they can make your life, they can take away your quote-unquote liberties and make things very difficult for you. Attorneys, prosecuting attorneys in particular, have a lot of discretion. When are we going to prosecute a case? When do we charge someone or not? Lots of discretion, as you, that's what this whole thing is about. And I said, wow, to me, this seems like Governor Scott is saying, I, as suspected racist, I have greater authority to exercise discretion than you to say what's going to be done. My discretion is greater than yours in the system of racism, white supremacy. That's how I'm processing that whole case, which will be interesting to check out. I had other comments, but I will leave it there for the moment. If folks could take about 5 minutes to share whatever commentary that you have, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Again, this is exclusive to the compensatory call-in. If we could not use metaphors, I've stated consistently, often racists, they use metaphors deliberately to be confusing, to compare things, analogies and similes, to contrast and compare things to things that are not equivalent. They do this on a regular basis. It causes confusion. It is a phenomenal way to be deceptive. Victims, non-white people, frequently we are still trying to understand the system of racism, white supremacy. As a result, a lot of times we have not come to conclusions, as Dr. Kanban advises. And as such, sometimes, hey, we employ metaphors, similes, analogies, just to hopefully convey our thoughts. And often it just adds to the confusion. It does not adequately convey what we want to say. And if on this broadcast, just the compensatory call-in, if we could just make every effort to just be direct, explicit to what it is that we want to say, that would be great. Super appreciated. I will prompt about that. With that, the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if it's a lot of background noise and what have you, if you could mute your line, right? That way, whenever you want to talk, I'll unmute. You'll be able to share. And then if you can mute your line again, that way we won't have a lot of distortion and, you know, excess noise to disrupt the broadcast. Thank you kindly. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Thomas. Greetings, Thomas in New York. About to enter the plantation. I had a few comments I wanted to make. You know, with that scenario you just read, I mean, or was talking about with the hotel clerk and the white guy saying he should lynch the other white guy, is that what happened?
Correct.
Yeah, I think that's just a codified way of people saying you as dumb as a nigga, you know, because who else do you associate lynching with? So, you know, man, you ought to be lynched for doing that, you know, so slow or doing it wrong. It's their way of saying, man, you know, you should be treated like a nigga. That's as dumb as a nigga would do. That's the way I look at that. That's just them being very codified and slick and, you know, their way of talking. The clip you played, I was on the train, so I couldn't hear them all, but it was talking about black people, their organs. And, of course, you know, that always touches with me because, you know, the job I have. And, you know, but one important part that they said was blacks could be harvested but not planted. And I just thought that was very, very interesting. And then what came after that was the melanin cliff. So I was like, oh, harvested for a reason. Now they done figured out a way to make some synthetic melanin, so they say it's synthetic, or we don't know if this is actually coming from them grinding black people up, taking melanin out of them, or what. All the missing black people all around the country and the world, and you know, Lord knows how many people they could grab in Africa, and no one will ever know, for them to create this. So melanin, was that a, what was the, was that like a visual clip, Gus, that you played, or was that just the audio? Because I would love to know what the doctor was that was doing this.
That was just audio. I'm sure that, you know, if you want to see what he looks like, I can look to see if they, I'm sure he has a picture or something online, but that was just audio.
Oh, okay. But that, I just thought that was, man, that was like their breakthrough of the 20th century there. They've been studying melanin for how long now? And if they're able to create a synthetic version, even though it seems like he's saying it's a topical cream that they can make out of it, I mean, that's just, you know, amazing. Not amazingly good, but I'm just saying, it's I mean, that's up there. And then he said that they could charge batteries with it. So I'm thinking, if you could charge batteries with synthetic melanin, then, man, we really have no chance. They're going to start charging batteries with us. Who knows what they're doing with people? You know, they could be getting away with all kinds of stuff. How are they figuring this stuff out? They have to be using people as a something to test against this synthetic urine. I mean, I'm synthetic melanin. I'm just really, that was a very good clip. I'm going to have to listen in the archives again so I could really take it in because I was walking. But that's the breakthrough of the 21st century right there. And I'll be my line. Thank you, Gus.
I thought that was very logical analysis about them using lynching, saying that to another white person to suggest that they should be treated like a nigger. Made a lot of sense, I thought. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele, and I am reporting from Pomona, California today. And I want to say that, you know, I want to report to other victims out here that the threat that law enforcement and race soldiers masquerading as law enforcement is, from what I can tell from firsthand experience, I think they are increasing their campaign to kill us extrajudiciously. I was recently in an encounter with a suspected race soldier that I'm convinced would have easily resulted in my death had circumstances been slightly different. I was parked in a parking lot. It wasn't an illegal parking space or anything like that, or it wasn't a restricted parking space. It was just one that was less utilized by people in the area that I was in. It was behind a gym, and I had just gotten out of the gym. And sometimes when I get out of the gym, I like to just chat with my friends from college, or you know, just catch up with people, even other Causal listeners. And I was just having a conversation with one of my associates, and I noticed that there was a pair of very bright lights that was shining in my direction. And this would be, I guess, what would be perpendicular to my car, and it would be on my passenger side. A few yards out. I'm going to guess a few, maybe 100 yards away or so. And I didn't think much of these lights other than the fact that they were really bright and they were, you know, kind of getting in my eyes. They weren't necessarily obstructing my view or anything like that, but they were definitely noticeable. And, you know, I didn't really know what to think of these headlights. I didn't see anything too suspicious, but I did note that in the area that I was in, in the conversation, I heard what sounded like gunshots in the distance. They could have been fireworks, so I just discounted it. It's close to the 4th of July celebration that people like to light fireworks on. So I didn't really think too much of it. But as these lights were shining into my car, I decided, hey, I'm going to move my vehicle so that I can get away from these lights. And I moved my car, and as I was moving my car into a different spot, the lights seemed to approach me. And as I'm parking in this alternate spot that's at a different angle, I could hear someone from the car with the lights say something to me. And when I turned, I noticed that these lights belonged to an SUV, a police SUV. And the person that was yelling at me was a law enforcement officer. And I couldn't make out their questions or instructions. So I lowered my window and I said, excuse me. And then the police officer began to yell and said, get your hands out of the car. What are you doing? You know, let me see your hands. And I said, look, I'm just talking on my phone, indicating towards my phone. He said, hands, hands, hands. And, you know, I put my phone in my seat. My friend or my associate was still on the other end of the line listening to this whole situation unfold. And the police officer was not listening to me. They were just, I'm noting that this police officer, every single word I was saying to the police officer seemed to just escalate the situation. And the police officer had no was just operating to escalate. Everything that the officer said was yelled at me. Anytime I moved my hands, his flashlight would, you know, zero in on my hands. He had his spotlight in my face, so I was a little disoriented. And I was just trying to explain that I'm in my car talking to my friend, and he is he's getting irate. I mean, he's saying, why aren't you listening to me? And I remembered the Terrence I remember the Betty Jo Shelby interview in 60 Minutes where she said that she repeatedly asked Terrence Crutcher, why aren't you listening to me? And so I noted that he's saying, you know, show me your hands. He's saying, why aren't you listening to me? I said, look, your lights were in my car. And then he denied that his lights were on until the stop initiated. And at that point, I realized this person is not even operating in the same space. He's not operating in the same truth. He's just lying. And he was reading my license plate to the person at dispatch, and he had his hand on his hip. And as he was reading my license plate, an explosion of police activity occurred a few feet from our position. We saw a few cop cars speeding by with their lights on. He immediately went into attention, looked at me, and it got into his police cruiser. He jammed on his accelerator so hard that I could hear his foot mashing on the accelerator, and I could see the streaks from his car, from my headlights. I could see the place where he left the whole scene. It was incredibly emotional for me. I mean, like, I have been in no-knock raids. I have had guns pressed to my chest by law enforcement. I've had guns pressed against my back by law enforcement. I've had guns pressed to my head by law enforcement. But in all of those scenarios, it seemed like they were, they didn't have the intention to kill me immediately. This person sounded like he was setting me up to be killed on the street. He was escalating the whole encounter from zero to very intense, and I have never been more frightened by a police encounter than that one that I just had. And I just want to say, it appears that they're sneaking up on people and they're setting people up to be killed. They're going to use a talk track to set you up to be killed. And I'm only here because I'm convinced that I'm only here talking to you guys right now because of that police action. And after that police action, there was helicopters trained over the spot where I encountered that law enforcement officer. So I have no idea exactly what was going on in the area. I just know that they were very intense. And I felt as though they were the police officer, the race soldier that encountered me. I'm sure he was going to kill me right on the spot. And he was using all the rhetorical devices that you hear on TV being used to set black people up for immediate extrajudicial extermination, execution right there on the spot. And I don't know. That's my report for this portion of the broadcast. Please be safe out there. They are not playing games. I'm convinced that they're just on a mission to kill all of us, regardless of if there's a reason or not. Thank you so much.
Wow. Glad you are safe, Mr. Steele. Say that, you know, regularly, that, you know, primary objective in these encounters, one, make sure that you survive unharmed, without being detained and what have you, and then you can proceed if things need to be further investigated. But glad that you're safe, and definitely to be very serious with these encounters. That's why I say at the end, you know, the sobriety day, and particularly this weekend, I forgot this is a holiday weekend especially, so you know they're going to have sobriety checkpoints probably all the way through Tuesday, I would think, maybe even Wednesday. Sobriety checkpoints and what have you, it's going to be a lot of enforcement officers, race soldiers, with badges roaming the streets over the next 4 or 5 days. I would keep that in mind and take it very seriously, as he said. And I would say, in particular, pay attention to some of those cues. If you see this is a suspected racist and he's being very aggressive, maybe cursing at you, may call you some names, might even, you know, call you a nigger. Who knows? Be very alert, be very careful, and I would even codify in those situations, I would have nothing to say. I think Mr. Edward Williams, he's been a guest on the program. He's the founder of the counter-racism.com website. He said that pretty much in those encounters, if it looks like this person might be jumpy or they're doing the Norm Stamper, remember we had him on the program, former Seattle police chief, he said he would do that. He would try to goad victims into responding so that he could put them in the chokehold and use his nigger knocker or whatever. He said that was his standard operating procedure. He said he's written about it, but just be mindful of that. And as Mr. Williams says, don't have anything to say at all. I just raise my hands. And I've done that myself. If it looks at all like this person might be jumping, looking like they're looking for their, hey, that's the one I can get a notch on my belt. Got to kill in action. Bang. Get me another star. Just put my hands up. I have nothing to say. Unless they ask a question or what have you. In those encounters, you just want to make sure you survive and then you can handle and do whatever you have to do. Remember what Mr. Fuller said. You do not have an army or reinforcements. You recognize when you are in a weak position. That for sure, you are in a weak position. Other folks that we've not heard from? Folks, dial in to spectate. There were other hands. Several other spectators.
Can I be heard?
That is amazing. Yes, ma'am. Hello? We can hear you. We can hear you. I had unmuted a number of lines, and then they all got muted again somehow. That is. Wow, I'm not sure how that happened. But yes, Princess, wonderful to hear from you, ma'am.
Okay, just give me a moment because I was actually notating some stuff here because I'm trying to go with the 5-minute rule. So
okay.
You can take the next caller, and I should be ready by then.
Yes, ma'am. Get yourself together. I'm going to deduct that 30 seconds from your 5. Wow. Just joking.
Okay.
Just joking. Other folks that we've not heard from at all?
Greetings.
Can I be heard?
I heard both of you, whichever.
Go ahead, bro.
Thanks a lot. This is Jay calling out of New York. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers and listeners. I guess I would say great clips, but unfortunate clips on a weekly basis. Definitely wanted to touch first on the melanin and the organs. Last week, and I think Red had provided some great information, some counter-racist engineering work on the Ohio coroner report about the white bodies that were piling up there from the drug overdoses. And when you hear stories about melanin, and Thomas in New York made some great points, I think from what I was listening to in the report, he really got kind of funny with his wordplay when they started saying synthetic. I think he really turned around and said it's not synthetic, but, you know, something that they kind of put together, but definitely tried to stay away from the word synthetic, which led me to believe, as I believe, that they're pulling this melanin from melanated people. So with that, along with the organ harvesting that's going on, I think a lot of it kind of really has targeted me in this whole area of really just trying to find out. I mean, all the online research that I've done, there has been no update in reference to any body counts. And then as we talk about large disasters, Haiti, New Orleans, Africa, I mean, you name it, heavily melanated locations where the body counts are in the hundreds of thousands, and you never hear about this, them having issues of what to do with the body. So again, it just kind of has me circling, and I'm definitely going to start looking to do some more research as much as I can to at least provide some information on that. And then you also heard that there's university dollars that's also being put behind this, and now cosmetic companies. So I tried to find out. They had a bunch of themes out there with melanin, the gram. I guess they were saying the amount of gram, the gram worth of melanin was kind of like up in the $398 per gram. I haven't been able to find any structured websites with that information, but I'm still looking, and I'll definitely share if I'm able to come up with it. The second thing that I kind of pulled out was the parents that are continually having to deal with these terrorized situations for their kids in school. And the common thread that you always hear is that, oh, this is the first time that these individual terrorists have done what they've done. Again, no different than in the case of the UAlbany students that I'm still really fired up about. Sorry for that metaphor, that I'm really upset about. That the individuals who did the terrorizing of the young ladies on that bus, no names, no information on these people. So they get to live their lives without any harm from this situation. No different than the Kendrick Johnson situation, where there were people that were on the tape. You still don't see the names that were listed. I think that there was a son of a detective or something, and that's really all I heard, that there was a son of a detective. Not hearing his name or anything that was kind of played out in the media. But this just really kind of perpetuates this. They're handling it, and you continue to see the individuals that are harmed by these individuals put out in the media by name, family, and everything else. And then the individuals that are doing the terrorizing, no information. Structuralized, the 3 T's right across the board, and that's all I have for now. I'll kind of try and gather my thoughts and come back a little later on. Thanks.
Appreciate that. Thank Big Victim. Thank you for your patience, sir.
Yes, sir. No problem.
Last year this time, or you're this big victim from Birmingham, Alabama. Last year this time, it all started on the 4th of July. Alton Sterling got killed in Louisiana. I'm staying in. I got to get up tomorrow. The plantation, my plantation is shut down. Won't be open till Wednesday. So I'll be staying in. Don't want to be out there. You can't distinguish firecrackers from gunshots. So I'll be staying in. I hope everybody be safe and stay codified. Thank you. Let me share.
Sound advice. Stay codified. If you are going to go out and, you know, do whatever, stay codified and be alert. Because when you got alcohol, white people, that is always a horrendous combination. But even alcohol and other victims, that can go, you know, really bad frequently. It does frequently. So just keep that in mind. If you are going to go out, you know, you still got to be codified. And if it looks like things are headed towards something non-constructive, it might be time to, you know, conclude the festivities and, you know, head back inside for a little while. Other folks, or I guess I'll check in. Princess, did you need additional time to gather yourself?
Yes, please.
Okay. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Mhandisi. Start off with saying, I will end the system of racism, white supremacy immediately. I wanted to speak about, first, a few weeks ago, I was talking about my research, the research that I did at this university with the head of the physiology department. And it didn't exactly fit into workplace racism the way I framed it, but I wanted to just read what I wrote. My research and experimentation on albino rats relates to workplace racism because white creatures, people, hired me to solve their health issues, thus helping them intentionally reproduce future generations of albinoid white creatures or people. Intentionally reproducing future generations of albinoid white creatures, people, is one of the highest crimes, as it allows another generation of white supremacy. By studying and attempting to correct type 1 diabetes, i.e. albinoid inability to process energy, heart complications, i.e. albinoid inferior cellular and tissue function, and cancer, i.e. albino and albinoid cellular degeneration from i.e. sun exposure, I was being used for the survival of white people, thus white supremacy. The other thing I was wanting to say was also related to workplace racism, is that when I was working, I'm still a realtor, but when I was working with this managing broker, the ice albino creature, who said, I can have that nigger killed by the morning, he was telling me that he had cancer, and he was trying to get me to help cure that cancer because he was familiar with some of the work that I had done previously. And he had already been to the hospital and all that, but he wanted my specific information, my specific ideas of how he could cure himself of cancer. And then what I wanted to say is, yes, absolutely, that is real melanin that they're using from black people. And I believe what I was using when I harvested the organs from these albino rats and we hooked it up to a machine, I believe the chemicals that we were putting in it, some of it was melanin, but we had so many different chemicals. I need to look back over my notes and study the structure of those chemicals to be sure, and I'll report back. When I speak I've noticed the ICE albinos, I suspect the ICE albinos are intentionally deleting segments of whatever I'm saying. And I don't usually waste my words. I usually use my words, and every word I say, I think counts. And so workplace racism, last week, the part that wasn't heard when I was talking about the professor, the black professor who invited me to his class, the part that wasn't heard was I was saying the black graduate students, because this was a graduate, a postgraduate level course, the black graduate students, their solution to solving this problem of what we're calling white supremacy was that we use violence. That was some of the, that was the solutions that they were coming up with. And the ICE albino monkey creature, the white person, that white female, she was comfortable with every solution, including the violence. The only thing that she was not comfortable with was my suggestion that she stop being white. That was the only thing that she wasn't comfortable with. The other thing is when we were speaking to the South African ICE albino monkey creature, I think that was in April of this year, I had spoken to, I was asking her a question, and the word South Africa was deleted out of my question. But it's not difficult to delete things over the telephone because of the delay. There's a delay in when someone's speaking and then when it's being heard, and you could just delete it in between that few second delay. And anyway, the word South Africa was deleted, and it was intentional, in my opinion, because it was it dealt directly with the question. My question was, how were albinos being treated in South Africa, particularly? By deleting that question, I mean deleting those words, South Africa, she ended up this ICE albino creature ended up talking about what happens to albinos elsewhere, thousands of miles away from wherever she is. And then the last thing that I wanted to say is actually a question. It's, what is your genetic definition of white person, or your phenotypical definition of white person? What is and what is not a white person? And I say that if we stop calling them white, that they will stop existing in this generation. And I think that from one year from the time that we stop calling them white, they'll stop existing within that year time because of all the things that will happen consequently of not calling them white. But my question is, what is your genetic and phenotypical definition of white persons? Thank you.
My answer to the question, and I think I said this consistently for the time that we've been broadcasting the cows, individuals classified as white, this is not based on genetics. White people, and this is documented, I've pointed to specific textbooks, White by Law, Ian Hani Lopez, guest on the program. There's documented evidence where white people just go and decide, this is a white person, this is not a white person. They might come back tomorrow and say, you know what, we changed our minds. The person we told you was white on Monday, now that it's Saturday, that individual is now going to be non-white, and it's because we say so. That's how their system works. There is a loose correlation between phenotype, but they change that around wherever they want, whenever they want. There's lots of evidence about this where people that do not look white people say they're white, and that's that. Someone looks white people say they're not white, that's that. Lots of evidence, lots of documented cases. That's the position that I've taken. I know some people do not agree. That's fine. But that's pretty much the stance that I've had the whole time that we've been broadcasting. Other people want to give their response to the question, feel free as we go. We're still going in the order of people who have not responded. People want to respond to the question who have already responded. Just wait till everybody's got their one opportunity to share, and then you can comment as well. Other folks we've not heard from, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I have also have stated previously in other programs that, from my understanding, And I think it coincides with logic that being a white person or not being a white person, it's a biological, it's not a biological construct, it's a political construct. White people are not going to make it that easy, that all you have to do is just destroy this formula. You're not going to make that easy. It's just like you said, they can switch it. They have the power to switch it and change it whichever way that they want to. I always have in my mind the example of the legendary Adam Clayton Powell. If you didn't know who he was, you would think he was a white person. He looks more like a white person than a lot of white people that I know. But I had never heard in my total knowledge of him being on the planet that a white person mistook him for being a white person. He was always associated as a non-white person. And I'm pretty sure there are millions of examples of that. Solving that problem would not be that easy at all. The week of racism, white supremacy. Just a running thought that's been in my mind for a week from listening to newscasts and whatnot consistently about the violence that's been heaped upon non-white people in this part of the world. I'm sure it's all over the world, but in this part of the world with what is called law enforcement, it indicates to me that we are as or maybe more vulnerable to the system of racist white supremacy as far as violent concern, including deadly violence. I would say probably, the reason why I would say probably more, because at least 50 years ago, I would say there was a higher content of non-white victims who were aware that you can get killed with no recourse. But I think there's probably a larger percentage of us who are confused because we have been bestowed with the opportunities to acquire more money, more status, as though that registrated in some sort of power. And it absolutely is incorrect in the thinking so. So that makes me aware that having a codified thought, speech, and behavior as an individual is essential. It's essential that you have to have that so you can be aware of, I think, the realities that's going on. In a little bit more mundane situation, I have lately, over the past year or so, taken up a hobby, model trains, primarily because of the interest I have in the layouts. You can make up whatever layout you want, as far as it can be something like a environment where people are figurines or whatnot. So it's unbelievable where this place is, a place that's located not too far from where I stay at. And there, as I stay, is 99.99% non-white people. But yet in the middle of this area, there are some white people that I haven't seen in years that's in this part of South Florida. And they have this warehouse where everything you want to know about model trains is in there. So I go in, and they have plenty of layouts. Along with the layouts is figurines, of course, of people. The only figurines they have on these layouts is black people who are wearing prison outfits. As I was leaving out of the place, I think yesterday, one guy decided to say, yeah, you may want to get this this police car. I said, well, the layout that I'm going to have is not going to be no need for any law enforcement. As I left out, and some friend to think about, because it got real quiet after I said that. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Princess, did you need more time to gather yourself?
I think I'm good now. I'm the caller from Florida. I just wanted to go over some quick notes, things that I had in mind that I came across over the week, and just some other information I wanted to share. I first wanted to speak on recently, although I don't really subscribe to him, Tommy Sotomayor did a recent interview with the guy, I believe it's pronounced Ari Nigel. He did a recent interview with him about, this is the white Jewish male who's fathered over 30 children with a whole bunch of black females, you know, just random black females, I guess, because they're trying to look for designer babies or whatever the case may be. And although, like I said, I don't subscribe to the show or anything like that, I found it constructive in that just observing the responses from the racist suspect, Ari Nigel, when he was asked about the fact that he himself is perpetuating single mothers in the black community. On several occasions, when he was asked very serious questions, he was found to be laughing or just being nonchalant about the whole thing. And the sad part was, it's because in some of the cases where some of these females, who I believe some are doctors, lawyers, pastors even, they might be, and I believe a few of them are in anti-sexual relationships or lesbians and stuff. And basically, he was stating that, you know, having the light-skinned children, you know, would help benefit the black mothers because of their many complaints of, you know, hair and stuff like that. And I guess in some case, one was indicating something about, you know, because they wanted their child to be Jewish. And I just thought, you know, that gave me a moment of pause as far as, you know, how so damaged and confused we are, and the lack of not knowing yourself, whether you're.
Princess, are you still with us? Not hearing anything from Princess? Just doing an audio check. Other folks, are you still with us? Is it just we're not, did we lose Princess maybe?
I hear you. She just cut off.
Okay. Yeah, it seems we lost Princess maybe. She got disconnected or what have you. If she dials back in, we will get her back on the line so she can continue her thought, most damaging, and then it went out. Anywho, other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from, other folks that we've not heard from, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I think what was there, like, a question about, I think, is, like, what's classified as white? I didn't get the question.
I think it was, what was your genetic definition for a white person? I think that was specified, your genetic definition or phenotypical definition for a white person?
Oh, okay. All right. I hadn't necessarily even come up with the definition. Perhaps I should, but I was thinking about that, and I shared this before. Richard Spencer, he spoke at Auburn University back in April 2017 this year. And I wanted to go back and look at that because that made me think about it was a question that was asked by a female, and she was like, it started out by her saying, well, you know, I'm quote unquote half white. Okay. And Richard Spencer, you know, he was pretty much laughing on the microphone, and she asked him, am I white enough? You know, she was sounding like, I guess she was confused. So the camera is behind her. So she looks like, the term looks, I guess, is referring to the visual aspect of whether or not someone is white. So he was saying, yeah, you look white to me. And she said that she was half white and Persian or something like that. And then he says, quote unquote, well, you're whiter than me, I guess, in terms of, I guess what they were saying looks. So, and then she asked another question. She said, you know, like, what's white enough? Like, am I white enough? So the other guy, he bombards Richard Spencer, and he says, well, you know, wait a minute. You know, do you ask that question to black people? All right. Do you ask them, you know, what's black enough? And then so she was saying, like, well, I was talking about this. So he says, I want you to ask a black person in this audience, what is black enough? So she turns her head, and apparently, I guess this is a black person in the audience, I guess, gave an answer. So she turned back to ask him again, I guess, about, you know, well, you know, what, like, how, where does white cut off? See, so now the question is switched again. It went from, am I white enough, and where does white cut off? Okay, so she was asking him that, you know, where does white cut off? Where does it cut off? Whatever that means. And that guy, the second white guy, he says, well, I didn't hear an answer yet. You're supposed to ask the black person first. And she was like, but I did. And then someone, you can hear a voice say, there's no such thing as black enough. Like, I'm going to repeat that. There's no such thing as black enough. And then the guy with the microphone, he says, oh, is that the answer we're going with? And then so he says, okay, well, I'll answer it. I'll just go with that. There's no such thing as black enough. So he basically said the same thing what they said the black person's answer was. So the other person went to go sit down. So, yeah, I wanted to look at that again to get the nuances. And that's all I wanted to share for now.
Richard Spencer, that guy. Other folks we've not heard from at all.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Roz, good to hear from you.
Hey, greetings to you guys, to all the other callers and listeners. I didn't get to hear the majority of the clips, but I did come in towards the end of the clips. And I just wanted to give an update. My father-in-law, he passed away this past Thursday. It was a very, surreal and powerful kind of situation. He was starting to improve really well. His bed sores were healing exponentially quickly. And as of Monday, we thought everything was going in a great direction. And Thursday, we were trying to give him fluids because he was dehydrated. And during that time, he started to aspirate. So eventually ended up having to perform CPR on him. The ambulance came, they took him, they put him on life support. And we had to wait for my son to come back from the city. He was out with his best friend for his best friend's birthday, which was the day before. So they kept him on life support long enough for my son to get home. He had a couple of relatives that came as well, and his one of his closest friends and his friend's wife. They all showed up, and eventually we were able to, my wife actually sang him home, and we were able to see him off to the land of the ancestors. he died on our anniversary, which I find to be very telling. 20 some odd years ago, he made me promise to take care of his baby girl, as he would call her. And I just found that to be very telling. I told my wife, I believe he chose to pass away that day, almost like a reminder to me of that promise to him. And white supremacy killed him. A lot of the problems he had as a younger man, we got rid of in his older age. He was actually healthier than he was for almost 30-something, 40 years of his earlier existence. So we were thankful for that. He tried to fight white supremacy by becoming a correction officer, due to white supremacy assaulting his family by three of his family members being involved in the situation known as the Trenton Six in the state of New Jersey, where six young black males were falsely accused of killing a white male, an elderly white junkyard owner in Trenton. And three of those people were his cousins. That incident is what spurred him to become a correction officer. And eventually, because the system assaulted him so viciously as a correction officer, he was promoted to sergeant. And because of the different things that he went through, he started to realize that the system was bigger than his aspirations to correct it from within. But while he was there, he did a lot of constructive things to help a lot of people adjust to prison life and to keep themselves on the straight and narrow while on lockdown. So I just wanted to just send my love out to my father-in-law, James McKenzie Jr. I wanted to thank you all for all of your prayers, thoughts, and well wishes. And I just thank you all for just being who you are. Like I said, it's so important to have this outlet. Thank you, Gus. Thank you so much, Gus. You've changed my life. You've really helped me to become a better counter-racist warrior in my perceptions and my thoughts and ideas and speech and action against the system. So I want to thank you so, so much. And to everyone else, I thank you all. You're wonderful, wonderful black people. And we are all like-minded people trying to replace this crummy system with a system of justice. And I wish you all the best and a safe holiday. Thank you so much. And I'll mute my line.
Our condolences to you and your family, Roz. Well, I know you've been talking about taking care of your in-law, your father-in-law, for seems like some years now, both you and your wife. I know definitely a lot of listeners who have heard you over the years and appreciate your commentary, years of commentary. I think at this point certainly will be praying for you, thinking about you, you and your family, and hoping all of you all can take care of each other at this difficult time right now. But man, that is certainly a challenging week, to say the least. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary that you wanted to share as well, if there's anybody that has not shared at all, I think we got Princess back as well. Princess, if you are back with us, if you wanted to resume, I'm not quite, you might have to kind of catch us back up on the...
Can I hear it?
Yes, oh. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I was just...
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. We can hear you.
Oh, okay. I have no idea what's going on. I know my Facebook page got shut down last week, so they might be on to me. I don't know. No, I'm just joking. But so I left off with the Ari Nigel stuff. I would just say just check out the interview. Like I said, I found it constructive. Some people may not or may not care, but it was just interesting listening to his responses throughout the interview. I wasn't sure whether or not, Gus, you had any clips discussing the incident with Serena Williams as far as the car accident that she was involved in here in Florida with an elderly person where it resulted in elderly white male dying, and how now they're saying that she may be possibly at fault. I just think it's highly Well, I can't even really say it's a suspect. I guess it's a standard operating procedure for them that they're going to probably try and really drag her through the mud now, especially with all the stuff that's going on in her personal life as far as with her family. And I won't say it's strange, but it looks like the white guy that she's about to have this baby from, it just seems like every time there's an incident with her, you don't hear anything from him. Like, you know, you don't hear him speak up for her or come to her defense. And I just find it strange that black females that are in these types of relationships, on the one hand, demand that from black males a lot, I hear in my circles, but it just seems like there's just a moment of silence when the scenario switched around. And I also was just putting it out there. There had been a report in the news here in Central Florida about the increase in biker gangs. The FBI was basically noting the fact of recent incidents, but they were saying throughout South Florida, I think, well, it's all of the biker gangs in general that they're saying that there's an uptick in activity, but they did report one of the gangs is the Dirty White Boys. They have a clubhouse in Davie, and the Black Pistons have one in Riviera Beach. They got the ones in Central Florida that are home to the Warlocks and the Pagans. And they have a chapter in Tampa. The only reason why I'm mentioning it is, like I said, there's been some recent incidents of violence with these biker gangs, as well as their influence as far as with the drugs, the methamphetamine, and all the other stuff that seems like it's been an uptick in. And last but not least, I guess the black female that I will say she was executed, the road rage incident where this black female was executed and gunned down. And I don't know, I just see this as, it's almost as if black people are just moving targets now for white people, I guess. And the fact that it's basically now, they're already describing this as, you know, just a simple road rage incident and nothing more, which is, I find it interesting, but, you know, not to be too surprised, but I would be curious to see how the media is going to continue to play out, you know, bits of this as the investigation continues and stuff. So, but other than that, I think I've pretty much covered everything. I don't want the line to get or my call to drop again. So I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking my call.
Can I be heard?
Good hearing from you, Princess. Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Okay. One thing to the sister, that was Venus Williams, not Serena Williams, that had got with the car accident, and I understand exactly what she's saying because the details state that she was going 5 miles an hour coming up out of her red light when she made that stop. So, yeah, this is very important that we recognize this because she wasn't maneuvering in her vehicle to a point to where she could actually damage them with a she couldn't damage them in a way that it would kill somebody. So what's not being told is what was his health state at that particular time, and they're just putting it on her because it ends up being that she was a prominent black woman that they could get some money from. I'm not sure if mm-hmm. that's what she was trying to say, but that's what I gather from that particular incident. He just so happened to die. This was an old man that was sick beforehand, and since it was a prominent black woman or black anybody that they could put this on and they could get some extra money from, this would be a nice chance or opportunity for them to do that. But that aside, what I was wanting to ask, Gus, first, next I would like to say thank you for taking my call, Gus, all of the callers. Like Brother Rod has said, is that you have changed my life also with all of the information that you give, the books that you recommend, different things of that nature. And I appreciate that. Thank you. What I wanted to get into, though, was when I called in a little late and I heard the Jay-Z, the story of OJ playing. Roz had put me up on this show, which allowed me to gather information from you and all of the listeners that follow you. I wanted to know what you got up out of that, not only the lyrics, but also the visual that came along with that, because me and Roz have talked from a counter-racist standpoint to look at that video and to hear the lyrics that was played alongside of that. And we had a long conversation about that, and I wanted to know what you thought about that and any of the listeners who listened to that song and also seen the actual visuals to go with it. Because while we were talking about it, he put me up on a movie called Coonskin that came out in 1975. And that put everything in perspective. And this was after we had the conversation, but that movie, Coonskin, put everything in perspective alongside of that. And before I get off of here, I just want to give a shout out to Roz, everything that he's done for his family. And hopefully all of us can practice black self-respect to be able to put ourselves in that particular situation and do the same thing that he's done for a number of years working on his step-parents. Thank you for taking my call, Gus, and I'll mute my line.
For sure, for sure. My thoughts, I guess others can offer their thoughts as well if you've actually seen the video. Even while moving and preparing for the program, I still had a moment in between the move to stop and see the new Jay-Z video for the story of OJ. And very interesting video. I think he exclusively released the video on Tidal, his streaming service. It's not on YouTube or what have you. So, I mean, there are a lot of layers to how you can, you know, look at what's happening. If you haven't seen the video, you should probably check it out. It's worth 3 minutes. Not super long. I think you can spare 3 minutes. If you don't have 3 minutes to spare because you're doing constructive things, then that's great. Stay on your grind. But it's animated. I thought that was interesting because he's such a well-known performer to have a video where you actually do not see him. The whole thing is animated. That stands out. And then obviously to be talking directly about racism for a good portion of the song, specifically when he talks... The story of OJ, when he talks about this moment where OJ says, you know, I'm OJ, I'm not black, I'm OJ. That reminds me every time when I hear that, it reminds me of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, because she talked about that moment as well several times. She thought it was a very profound moment illustrating his confusion. Now I think of the ESPN film, which They also mentioned that moment where OJ was having this conversation, the ESPN documentary that came out last year, which I've not seen. The only part that I saw that floored me, it was great. If the rest of the film is like this, then it might be worth the whole 8 hours to watch. But a white person talks about that moment and says he was present when some white people at a table said, "Oh, there goes OJ Simpson and some niggers." He didn't say black people. He said niggers. "There goes OJ Simpson and some niggers." And the white person said, "Oh my gosh, I'm sitting with OJ." And this is when OJ is in USC. So he's like in his young 20s. And he says, "Oh my gosh, Juice, I'm so sorry that happened. My gosh." And he says that the young OJ, USC, says, "Oh, no problem. It's great. You know, they said I'm OJ. They don't even think of me, you know, as a black person. I'm OJ. Woo, it's the greatest day of my life." And he said, the white guy in the ESPN documentary, he says, "From that moment, oh, I knew OJ was effed." And I was like, whoa, let's get more detail. What do you mean? Break that down, sir. But they didn't do that. They just cut to the next thing. But those are two things I immediately think of, and all going back to Dr. Welsing and her analysis of his confusion in that moment. But yeah, those were two things I thought of immediately, and him using that to kind of express, even someone like me with all the money that I have, or my wife with all the money that she has, still nigger. Great. I enjoyed it. The animation I thought was great as well. I don't know. I haven't had enough time to research to figure out, you know, who the animators were for the project and what the thinking was and why they decided to go that route with a major release video for his new project. But yeah, I thought it was great. Maybe even black self-respect, although it did seem like a lot of it focused on money. He made some comments about Jews later in the song. There are a lot of black Jews as well. He did veer into a lot of money talk, where it seemed one might, I could see where some people might view that and think that the problem is money, not racism. Based if you listen to some of the lyrics, but thought it was constructive, definitely worth checking it out. People should maybe give it a view. Is anybody we've missed completely? Any listeners that we have not heard from at all who have a hand up? Do we get everybody? Anybody that we missed completely who has a hand up? Great. Yeah. Yes, Princess.
No, I just wanted to say sorry. That was a misread by me as far as the story with Serena Williams.
All right. Yeah, I was gonna.
Her other sister Venus.
I was gonna say that as well. I thought it was Venus, but the listener got the correction. We got the correct information. There was.
But I still stand by the.
Hang on one second, though. There was a report in U.S. Weekly.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Venus Williams breaks her silence on the fatal car accident. Just gives more detail, and then you can, if you want to add, you can do so, Princess. The report reads, Venus Williams has broken her silence. The tennis star took to Facebook on June 30th to express her thoughts on the tragic car accident she was involved in that left a 78-year-old man dead. "I am devastated and heartbroken by this accident. My heartfelt condolences go out to the family and the friends of Jerome Barson, and I continue to keep them in my thoughts and prayers," Williams wrote in the emotional post. The deadly collision occurred on June 9 in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, where Williams lives. According to TMZ, Barson's wife, Linda, told police she had been approaching an intersection in her Hyundai Accent sedan when Williams' Toyota SUV darted suddenly, causing Linda to T-bone her vehicle. Williams reportedly told police she had been attempting to make it through the traffic while driving 5 miles per hour when she had to slow down, causing her SUV to block the right of way. Another driver at the scene alleged that Williams had sped into the intersection, though Williams' lawyer disputed the claim. Linda suffered broken bones while her husband was taken to ICU at St. Mary's Medical Center with head trauma. He died 14 days later. Citing a police report, TMZ reported that Williams has been found at fault for violating the right of way of Barson's vehicle, but there was no evidence that she was under the influence nor that she had been distracted by her cell phone. The 37-year-old athlete is facing a lawsuit from the family of the victim. And that's the report from U.S. Weekly. I did think it was interesting. It just seemed like it was thrown in kind of a haphazard way, that there was no evidence that she was under the influence or that she had been distracted by her cell phone. It just seemed like it was structured. Even if they wanted to make sure that that was clear, if they were thinking people might have had suspicions, if you want to go that route, fine. It seems that it could have been written about. Maybe my journalistic standards are low for, or are too high for U.S. Weekly. But yeah, that's this report. I don't know. Princess, did you have additional commentary?
No, I was going to say, I guess part of my confusion was because, you know, for the past week or so, I think it's been the story with Serena, of course, with this other tennis player. And then, you know, now it's come to light that their father's going through this divorce with their mother. And it's almost as if the way it's being orchestrated and paraded in the media, it's almost as if they're just showing all this dysfunction within the family itself. Not that they're doing it per se, but it's just a lot of chaotic incidents and stuff going on within the family. Like, it's just always something going on. So, but I mean, I still stand by my statement as to the fact that her fiance has been, you know, silent throughout all of this, you know, as far as him, you know, with this latest incident with this other tennis player making the comment he's made, you know, the fact that, you know, any of these incidences, you know, he's not saying anything or coming to her defense on anything. It's just, it's fascinating, but, you know, it is what it is.
Right, right. I think, unless I'm in error, I think we got all of our callers. We have about 30 minutes left in the program, less than that, actually. So if there are folks listening, if you have a comment, if you want to respond to any of the questions that have been raised, genetic definition for a white person, or thoughts on the Jay-Z new video, feel free. 641-715-3640. The code 564-943#. Press *6 if you would like to participate. I also thought it was very important, that shooting that Princess mentioned. We did have a sound clip on it. The young black female, just was going to make sure I got her full name. I just tweeted it. I'll get her. But she was shot and killed by some random race soldier who fled the scene after killing her. This is at least the third incident that I can recall of this nature since August of last year. Deborah Pearl, she was in Ohio, black female, black mother in her 50s, where some just random psychopath, this white guy gets out of the vehicle, and I think he shoots her like multiple times with like an assault rifle. And then they also had Joe McKnight, the situation down in Louisiana, right off the Crescent City Bridge, where he shot and killed him. I think that was right at the end of 2016. But lots of these types of incidents. Bianca Nicole Robertson, that's her name. And they didn't even release at first. They just talked about it as a quote-unquote road rage incident. They didn't even release the information until later that, oh, no, she was actually shot and killed. And then her car ran off the road. This wasn't just a crash and a dispute between someone. Oh, you cut me off or something like that. Did folks have any commentary on this incident? I don't know if this is.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir. Thomas in New York.
Have you heard? That's to be expected. And, I kind of predicted with Trump's presidency, we'll see an uptick in this type of random, you know, not just the police being emboldened, but the average white person just being emboldened to just run someone off the road, or, you know, see some black kids walking on the side of the road and pick up truck or something. So I expect to see a lot more of these type of incidents going forward. First, I want to say my condolences to Roz. You know, I'm sorry to hear that. I know you've been taking care of your stepdad. I mean, father-in-law for some time, and you know, I'm sorry to hear that. My condolences to you, your wife, and your son, and the rest of your family. And also, I'm sorry to hear about what happened to Ken Steele. You know, any time I've ever been stopped by police, kind of had the same feeling you had when you get lost, you know, like, you know, you had that feeling like, oh, man, you know, you're so mad because there was nothing you could do about it, and you feel like, you know, your plot has been kind of taken, and it's just a horrible feeling. And I feel like they get off on it. You know, as far as Serena Williams, from the clip you played, it's come to the point where, you know, this is tennis. This is an all-white sport. Mostly white males play this sport, even though it's a lot of non-white people who play it. But I would say predominantly a white sport. And then you have the best tennis players in the world. And for a white man, I said this to Laz the other day. I said, you know, for a white man to gauge their greatness in a sport that only they play, she's the 300 best player in the world, you're saying? Like, imagine them trying to put a black woman up in the caliber of an NBA player or a boxer or something that, you know, or football, depending on the position. They wouldn't even be one of the 30 millionth best player. I mean, it wouldn't. This is where you gauge yourselves. That's just how weak they are genetically. And I think that was just him really just saying, listen, you know, it's only 300 white men in the world are better than her in a sport. That's pathetic. And that's how I look at it.
Before you move on, I thought he said 700. I thought he said 700, not 300. I thought he said she would be ranked 700. I can double.
Well, if she's 700, that's still pathetic.
Me too.
If he said 700, it's still pathetic. What sport could you? I mean, just think of it this way: we gauge the way that they're gauging her is the same way we gauge white people when they play our sports. I mean, we got one white player in basketball history that we're going to put in the top 2,000 of Larry Bird. Who else is going to be named there? I mean, it just shows how inadequate they are. This is where she's at. Do y'all have to put her in your rankings? When you sat down and actually did some mathematical statistics to try to figure it out, 700? I don't see it. To me, the definition of a white person in America is different than other places. However, politically, if anybody that white people are considered to be white, it could be us tomorrow if they wanted to. We could get some loans and some stuff like that, but I doubt it. But either way, but genetically speaking, I would say the stock of people that come from the Western and Northern European regions of the world, they don't know how they got there. They just ended up there somehow one day. And that's the people that I would call genetically white. And I think that plays out when you look at Europe, how they discriminate against other whites. In particular, like with the Brexit, when the Polish people were getting beat up in English, they didn't consider them white. They're all white. So it's just depending on how you look at it.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I would. I will express my condolences to Mr. Ross and his family for their loss. I also think that Ms. Princess was making a very good point. The white party in these tragic relationships is not even pressured to speak on the behalf of that non-white person, let alone talking about themselves saying anything. Whereas the non-white person of a complete non-white relationship is duty-bound to speak up, which I don't have any problem with the non-white person speaking up on behalf of their quote-unquote loved one. But also with this situation with Serena Williams, I just have a thought. I mean, the racism, the blatant racism that she and her sister and her father have been involved with since they were little children. It's like, you know, real crazy. Then again, this is the system of racist white supremacy and what it does to non-white people. It makes us not to make good decisions. You would figure of all of that experience that she has of racism, white supremacy, that she would not even come close to being that intimate with a white person. And in this case, a white male. It's just, you know, it's white supremacy, you know, as far as that's concerned. And yeah, that's kind of like my thoughts on it. You know, every time I see that photograph of her posing naked, you know, and knowing on who is the father of that child, wow. You know, I would like to be somewhere in ears shot the first time they have an argument and he calls her a nigger, and what her reaction would be then, you know, as far as that concern. You know, that ought to be interesting. But, yeah, those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
I heard both of you. I guess we'll get Roz first, and then we'll get Mr. Steele.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Gus, for letting me speak. Thank you all so much. I appreciate your kind words and thoughts. And he lived till 88, so I just wanted to let everyone know he did live until 88. But I just believe that none of us die of natural causes in the system. It's just not designed for that to be the case. And that until we get rid of the system, we'll never really know how long we can survive as Black people as far as our lifespan, just based on the system not being designed to happen. I wanted to say, in reference to Serena, a lot of the firefighters' thoughts I concur with, because that's exactly how I thought, especially after we had read Richard Williams's book. I thought that they would have been raised to be less confused. Of course, you know, there's no judgment on Mr. Williams or his wife. It's just, hey, you know, you do the best you can, and sometimes you don't always, or you're not always able to impart the information that you wish to impart to your children. So, yeah, I thought it was very interesting when I saw the cover of the magazine with her posing. I thought two things. I thought of when, I think it was last year or the year before, when they compared her to a horse. I think it was a Sports Illustrated cover where some white media people basically compared her to a horse, as far as just, I think the horse was like some sort of prize winning stallion or something. And when I saw the photo, I just thought, wow, her giving white racists that visual and them already comparing her to an animal, I could just see them further comparing her to an animal. And beyond that, also, she is literally incubating the living definition of white genetic annihilation. She has her like President Obama was the living visual of white genetic annihilation. Her child is going to be the same. And I truly like the firefighter said, I would like to see what be around for when he does call her a nigga. If I'm not mistaken, he's the guy who was the founder of Reddit. So he's not like a poor white man. But he's affluent, but then I don't believe he has anywhere near the money that she has. And it just takes me back to J.A. Rogers, Sheik Antijab, Tiger Woods, all the other prominent Black people, whether male or female, who end up in tragic arrangements. And again, the fact of the matter is, in those relationships, these white people, if anything happens to the Black person in the relationship, which tends to be the case, the Black person, for some reason, always seems to die first. And what happens is these white people who they're married to end up being the recipients of all of their hard work, and none of their descendants or relatives that are usually in poverty and just really need the financial assistance They never get access to that money. The white person that they were married to never marries black again. They go back to being white and continuing to practice racism with their white counterpart, and they get all of the financial benefits of the hard work of the black person who they were raping for however long they were married to that person. So it just gave me a lot of pause for thought with that. As far as the concept or the idea of what would be phenotypically genetically white, I agree with what Gus said. I agree with what the firefighter in Florida said. And I would also agree with Thomas in New York. From what I've been able to determine, white people have come into existence about 6,000 years ago through the process of genetic mutation with East Indians, Dravidian black Indians from East India, who were practicing incest. I don't know what the reason was, but that created the genetic mutation to albinism that birthed white people as we know them, and that was about 6,000 years ago. And there's a great website called Real History WW that gives a comprehensive genetic and pictorial history of white people that and scientific that really will help people solidify their understanding of where these people came from. And they ended up having to migrate to Europe from India to escape being microwaved to death by the sun, and they propagated there, which we now see as these people that live amongst us terrorizing us every day. So with that, thank you so much, and I'll meet my line.
Mr. Steele?
Awesome. Still in... I'm actually in Chino. Sorry, in Chino now. I wanted to just say to the caller that was asking for what a definition of white was, especially a genetic definition. And I thought, you know, no better than the source themselves, the white supremacists. You can go to stormfront.org, and you can see that they have a prominently displayed a topic called "Read This Before Asking," quote, "Who is white?" And this is kind of an extension of their guidelines from posting. It's by a poster named David Cooper, and he basically says that it's a very long post, but the summary is so again, in response to the question, who is white, we answer, quote, non-Jewish people of wholly European descent, no exceptions. And if you tell us you're not, we will believe you. And earlier in the post, they give an example. If someone were to say that they were 12.5% Amerindian, which is a term that they use to describe non-white people who were indigenous to the United States or to the, American continent, or what we call the American continent. Then as far as we're concerned, that's what they are. 1/8 non-white. This is something about which we can't compromise. Either you're white or you aren't. And I like Neely Fuller's definition, I believe it might be Gus T. Renegade's definition that says those who classify themselves as white. And I do believe that white is a classification. I think that it's entirely subjective. I think it is based on what the prevailing white supremacists of the moment determine it is, and I think that you are in error, and you are making a very vain attempt to try to ascribe some sort of scientific or logical definition of white beyond that. Once you start trying to parse out what gene is white or what set of phenotypical characteristics are white, then you will observe that these characteristics can be observed in those people who are classified as non-white. And I think that Real History WW website is probably one of the most constructive web pages on the internet. Their article on the true Negro is definitely something that I suggest
all victims of racism read, especially those who have questions as to what is black and what is white. And then finally, regarding the Jay-Z video and song, you know, I caution victims of racism to get too excited about depictions of words or any sort of speech that is anti-black being presented as constructive. This is what the white supremacists had us doing with the so-called N-word, and we are at the point where that word is being frequently used against us, and we are quickly pointed to as the responsible party for that victimization through the vehicle of hip hop. You know, it's those racist cartoons that were produced throughout our history. When I was a child, they finally got, I believe it was the Speedy Gonzalez cartoons removed. And that was kind of the last of the racist cartoons that were produced by Warner Brothers and Disney that were allowed to be aired on public television. I'm scrolling in my news feed in 2017, and I just happened to see fresh, brand new, never before seen racist cartoon depictions of black people that are akin to those depictions that we fought to get removed from the public airways. I suspect that this video is going to be used as an excuse for racists to go ahead and resurrect or bring about these racist depictions of black people in the mainstream, these more racist depictions, of black people, or less codified depictions of black people on screen. So I'm taking a very cautious approach to this song and this video. I was incredibly disturbed by the visuals, and I was not moved by the lyrics. So, you know, I'm very, very cautious about that display. There's a lot of very suspicious activity that's surrounding this album and some of the news and the media that's surrounding this album as well. So, you know, victims of racism, be very cautious about the media that you consume. And I will align.
Appreciate that. The caller, we had someone who has not shared at all. The caller at 4499. Did you have commentary?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me? Okay. How's it going, Gus?
Right, poorly.
Wanted to put in an observation I had on what it means to be white. And from what I'm seeing, it seems like to be white is just a uniform. It's not a race. And if you look up the definition of uniform,
The question specifically, I just want to make sure the question specifically wasn't, you know, what does it mean to be white? The question specifically, I believe, was what is your genetic definition for a white person? What is your genetic or phenotypical definition? That was the specific question. I think that does make a difference. Go ahead, sir. Sorry for interrupting.
No problem. Not changing in form or character or remaining the same in all cases and at all times. That's what it means to be white. And if we use the Neely Fuller's definitions of Neely Fuller says that we look at it as a noun and it's more of a verb, like to be a police officer, to be a nurse or whatever. It's what you do. It's not a uniform, if you get what I'm saying. And if you think of it like that, police are just wearing costumes. Nurses are just wearing costumes. Their uniform is white. What they do is consistent. These are just costumes. And if you think about what Neely Fuller says about holidays, it's just every day, a whole day. like Halloween when we wear costumes. And I think this could be just, you know, one big game with costumes, because the uniform is definitely the skin. And what we think a uniform is, it's just a costume. And that's my observation. I just wanted to get my input in.
Appreciate that. Thank you, sir. Yes, sir.
Yep.
I did want to make sure I got in with the report. The female that was shot and killed, she was 18, that was shot, Bianca Nicole Roberson, who was shot and killed by this race soldier who got away. Don't know his name, no identifying information. In this report, they reported her death. They released a sketch of the suspect. They did not identify him as white. And I made note of that when I posted about this. And said, all this is, you know, fresh, new. I think all of this happened right at the end of the week. Because they released a sketch yesterday, Friday afternoon. I think this was within the last 24 hours. And that, I stated my view on this consistently. One of the problems, one of the reasons we have not solved this problem, we do not accurately understand what it means to be white. And consistently, when racists, white people, go out and commit these sort of crimes, they are not explicitly identified as white. We've talked about this, and people have done research on this, how they will be very flagrant. It was a black person, or whichever area it is. It was a Negro, or it was a Negro, whatever it is. It was a colored who robbed the store, or who did this, who did that. They do not do that with individuals classified as white. And I've said consistently, that's one of the main problems. If non-white people, black people, had an accurate understanding of what it means to be white, if every time you don't just put that sketch up, this is what the suspect who killed this young 18-year-old who just graduated, this is what he looked like. No. A white person did this. We don't know who it is, but we know it was a white male. This is the age. If that was happening and this is what we connected to white every time, we would solve this problem quickly, I think. That's the problem. People don't do that. People do not have an accurate understanding of what it means to be white. And consistently, people are not even identified as white. That information just conveniently gets left out all the time, particularly when white people are practicing racism, white supremacy. That just gets left to the side, to their benefit every time. And I would also just add, I think it's a fact. You have a substantial population of non-white people on the planet right now who are not calling the individuals classified as white. They're not using that term to describe them. You have a substantial population of non-white people on the planet who do not use that term at all. They don't speak English. They have never seen an individual classified as white. I've not seen any evidence that people just not using that word, the number of non-white people who are classifying these folks as white, who use that terminology, them just not saying that term is going to end racism in a year. I've seen no evidence of that at all. And I've said the same thing because I've heard that view expressed before. It sounds very similar to the people who say that they have a problem. To me, it sounds very similar to the people who say that they have some sort of problem or concern with the term white supremacy. At the end of the day, for me, it's fine. Whatever term you want to use, that's fine. United, independent, use whatever is going to be necessary to solve the problem. But at the end, I have not seen any evidence presented that if non-white people just stop classifying white people as white, that somehow that will solve the problem or these folks will not exist, particularly within a year. No evidence at all. We have about 3 minutes left. Folks have commentary they needed to get in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Just wanted to touch real quickly, condolences, as many have said, to Roz and his family. Roz, thank you for your contribution, kind of connecting the dots here as I started listening to the Cows probably about a year and a half ago. Just wanted to touch real quickly on the Jay-Z. I agree with Mr. Steele. I do feel it's the same old adage where they kind of sprinkle a little bit of truth. And then they push this information that the white agenda is trying to get out there to further confuse the masses. I also kind of rarely fall into it, but the amount of attention that's already been given to this album is very concerning, because I know that there's so much, and I know that there's some information that just came out that said now his mom has come out of the closet and she's practicing anti-sex. So it's always something larger that they're trying to push out there. And I just kind of caution everybody to just be careful as we take this information in. That's all I had. Thanks.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. So my question as to the genetic and phenotypical definition of white, I do understand what's being said, but again, how can a group of people fear genetic annihilation if there is no genetic relation? These people are literally the easiest people to identify. We can tell that they're not from South Africa, they're not from North or South America. We can tell that they're not from Australia. We know that there's a group of people who's coming from Northern and Western Europe, however you say it. We know that there's a group of people who invaded. Well, that's the people I'm talking about. But then when we say white, then you can include George Zimmerman, and so now, he's a Mexican. But
I never heard him classified as white. I never heard someone. Hang on one second, because I didn't hear George Zimmerman identify himself as white. I heard a lot of confusion about that, but I never heard him definitively say that he was white. And we have about 30 seconds left.
Okay. I thought that he was identified as white in certain news.
That's true.
I still don't understand that. Yeah. I just don't understand. If they can be genetically annihilated, how can they not be genetically related? But maybe another time. Thank you.
For sure. That is true. What you said in terms of there were many news reports that said he was white. But what I said specifically, I never heard George Zimmerman identify himself as white. And that's where all of the confusion would stop for me. It wouldn't be, well, this news report said he was white, or this person said white. Well, is he? Let's just go look on his driver's license or just ask him directly. And I never heard him say directly that he was a white person. So, that I stopped even identifying him as a white person. But nonetheless, moving forward, we'll be here. Compensatory call-in is every Saturday, but we'll be back before then. The book club Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Gil Scott Heron will be here Thursday for Workplace Racism. And I suspect we will be here for Tuesday, July 4. I'm just trying to get settled with things, but I think that probably will happen. Just check the Facebook page, Black Talk Radio Network, and you'll see the date and time. If we do everything, it'll be normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, if we do broadcast on Tuesday. Stay tuned. Thanks for the folks who tuned in. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Drop an email if you get confused, if you cannot find something in the archives, have a question, or disgruntled about whatever gripe. UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. That's it for sure. We'll say it again. Sobriety would be best at any time, but especially this weekend. Any so-called holidays tend to be an excuse for a lot of excessive drinking or just general consumption of intoxicants, reckless behavior, especially now since it's warm and what have you. People are going to be out driving, and enforcement officers will also be out. So just keep all of that in mind. I think sobriety would be best. If you decide that you want to party and have fun, fine. Just make sure that you're codified. I suggest typically go to one place and stay there. If you're going to party, get together with some folks, fine. Make sure that it's all non-white people. Pick one house, get whatever you're going to do, and stay there. That way you can leave the next day when everybody is sober, and it shouldn't be a problem, or it should be less of a problem than if you leave at 11, 12, 2 in the morning and are intoxicated, and it's a holiday where you got Daniel Holtzclaw out waiting and asking you to give him a breathalyzer, and let's make sure that you can drive this vehicle. At any rate, thanks for tuning in. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.